Committee on Deb Crossley, Chair, and Councilor at Large from Ward 5. To my left is Susan Albright, Councilor at Large from Ward 2. And then Barbara Bussell Blazer, just seated, Ward Councilor from Ward 3. And Cheryl Lappin, Ward Councilor from Ward 8. Mark Laredo, Councilor at Large from Ward 7. And our committee clerk, Nadia Khan. I am aware that some, at least the president is going to be late. Not sure where everybody else is, but we have a quorum. We'll get started. The first item on the agenda is Comcast. Would the gentleman like to join us at the table? It is item number 395-16. This is a Comcast petition for a grant of location on Huntington Road. Welcome.
My name is Manuel Patel. I represent Comcast Construction Department. Comcast is requesting to place a conduit starting at pole number 673/7 on Hunter Street, trenching 340 feet Street, placing one 3-inch conduit in the existing vault in front of 75 Hunter Street.
Okay, and this is in Ward 7. So we're all aware of that. We had simply one drawing submitted in our packet indicating the location on an aerial view. So are there any questions for the petitioner? None at all. Is there anyone here to speak for or against this petition? Yeah, would you state your name, please?
Hong,
and your address, please?
75.
Thank you.
My question is, I know my house, right?
Mm-hmm.
And are you going to put anything in front of my house?
No, what it actually is a vault. So let me explain. Are we putting something in front of your house? Let me explain. Yes, we are. But it's not above ground. Everything is below grade. So what's happening is we have a couple of poles that need to be removed from that property area. The only way we can remove those poles is to build this underground.
We don't have a pole.
Not on your property. It's coming in from a different direction. They're basically coming in that street underground. So we're requesting that an underground piece, an aerial piece, which is coming from a different direction, is required to go, this requires this section to go underground so that we can remove that section. It's basically a requirement that we need to put the cabling underground. So what we're requesting is that it comes from an existing pole underground, and what will be in front of your house on town property, so it will not be on your property, it will actually be on town property, will be a vault, which is a 24 by 30 inch vault in the ground. And it will be on town property, usually right behind the sidewalk. You don't put it in front of
the sidewalk. It's close to my front yard.
Correct, behind the sidewalk. And we usually place it right on the edge of the property line. That's usually where it will get placed. Simply because if you ever request service at a later date and we have to service the house, you don't have to keep coming back here for a permit to go 3 feet onto your property. So typically, this is to service your property and then obviously other properties in that area.
We have an aerial map, by the way, if you would like to take a look. I'm sorry, is that the wrong one? Sorry, different suit. Even with my glasses, I can't see the small print. I don't think there is any. Is it?
I have one.
We had only one.
It's
this one.
Yeah, can I ask you a question for clarification?
Go ahead.
So the conduit's underground.
Mm-hmm.
The box you were describing, is that on the underground?
Right. Ground level.
Ground level, so it's visible from the sidewalk.
Correct. You'll see a 24 by 30 inch vault cover, but the actual box is underground. So it's actually. So you could ride a lawnmower over it. It's not going to affect it. It's below that grade.
And given what 75 is like, is there a sidewalk there?
Correct. So we'll be coming underneath the sidewalk and then placing this wall behind it.
But if the property line is at the back of the sidewalk, then you're going to have to go into the sidewalk.
Correct. And we would place it in the sidewalk. In that case, that might change. We won't normally put a vault in the sidewalk. We'll try to get it before the sidewalk, usually between the curb and
I'm looking at a picture. Should we show them the picture?
Yes,
could you just, using this picture, show us where you think it would be?
Okay, so take a look at it.
I'm going to hold it up.
Yep. It would most likely be coming in this general area right there.
In the grass area?
In the grass area. Right
okay.
There.
So you're going to have about a something about this wide, maybe?
This is your driveway.
The metal. Yeah,
yeah.
The metal.
Yeah.
So you
can
just
sit
here and
found
my mailbox.
Well, it would probably be off to the side of your mailbox. It has to be where your mailbox is.
So you're only going to sit in this side. Going
to
the sideways?
No, we don't go in. That's not going in onto your property.
Only the grass side.
Grass side. This is a sidewalk right here.
Uh-huh.
They're going to have to sit exactly where that property line is. If that property line is right on the edge of the back of that sidewalk, then we have to come to the front of the sidewalk.
Okay.
If your property line is back, let's say 3 or 4 feet, then we would put it there instead of over here.
Which one's better? And you hold, which one is better?
What you prefer, not what we prefer. I mean, if you don't have a problem with it, it's the property line.
I prefer outside. I don't want
okay.
to go inside.
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Could you figure out a way to communicate with
you? You own your business until you get permission from the owner, because we're going to have to hold that
I'm
whole area.
I'm going to ask Lisa Verna to speak to this. I'm going to
finish everything.
Mm-hmm.
You still look like that, right? Nothing.
Pretty much, yeah. What you'll see is the new trench coming down the road, which will be a brand new asphalt.
Up,
it'll be an asphalt run down the
so
lane.
Going to fix here, so
right, right down the
road.
Road. Yep.
Okay.
Right down the lane and then come in.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Our city whatever. Our city engineer would like to say a few words. Lisa Verna?
Yeah, Lisa Verna. Just a point. How do you think the front way from property line of between number 61 and 69 Huntington Road easterly? So technically the project you're approving is really the part that's west of the property line of 61, 69 only. And you said 69 is a private matter between Verizon and owners of the private way, technically. This is a very good discussion on that. I'm happy about the homeowner.
75 is the eastern side. Is eastern towards
the
right.
75 is kind of
within
the private way.
Right. Right.
I mean, it's a good discussion. I'm glad the owner understands technically what Verizon is proposing, but technically it's within the private way.
So because of the fact that it's in the private way, we're petitioning because we're going to be, some of it's going to be on the public way. We also need to talk to the owners, obviously, and get permission to go into where we need to be in there.
So how do you do that? Do you convene a community meeting?
We typically contact the owners directly. We'll contact 75 directly before we do any trenching. Before we leave here, I'll give you my cell number so that you can call me and talk to me directly, and we can work it that way. And typically, that's the way we do it.
Before you have some kind of line, everything's outside.
Correct.
I don't know why, it's just
outside,
on the ground. On the ground.
Part of this whole issue that we're dealing with. And this is why we need to get underground in there. We need to literally place everything in this area underground in that area.
So we're underground utilities, which is something that we and the committee have talked to. I know Councilor Albright has been a particular champion of that, but we've talked about
this table. We're lucky to be able to do it over in this area.
Okay.
Who participated in this? Was it a private request?
There was a private request coming in from another customer that's requesting underground services to be brought down. We're in the middle of a rebuild, retro, I should say, in Newton, so it just falls in at the right time for us to be able to do this.
Okay. Any other places we can do it?
There is actually a couple left. There's another one sitting here.
That's
right. On the list.
It's
kind of taken a new approach to new construction, new areas, new buildings. We try to do as much underground now as possible.
It's great to hear.
Talk to the other utilities.
Sorry. It's just a thing that Comcast currently is working, especially in Newton with the upgrades that's going on. We're trying to get as much of our equipment.
So just so we're clear, we're only voting on what is in the public way.
Correct.
Okay. So there's no sense in our conditioning this to place the metal plate in a particular location because that is completely up to the owners of the private way.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm ready to move.
Can you see that picture of what that box looks like?
We can bring one up and look at it.
Is the box outside the fence or
underground?
Everything
is flush.
Grade?
Correct, it's flush to grade. So the actual. You'll see it, it's a box, don't get me wrong, you'll see it, but you can run a lawnmower over it and not get it. I mean, it wouldn't.
You'll only see the cover, though.
You'll only see the cover, not the low grade.
I'm going to suggest that we have one more petition to cover with Comcast that you all might want to have a conversation in the hall before the night is over. And if there's nothing else that you'd like to say as far as our grant of location in the public way is concerned, I would be ready to close the public hearing. Are you all set? Because I don't believe there's anyone else here to speak on this petition. Is that right? Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing and ask for a motion.
I'll make a motion, but can I have a question for the Commissioner of Public Works?
Sure.
So, Commissioner, it's wonderful to hear a utility actually talk about undergrounding. Have you had any thoughts, and I know we're going to talk about roads later, this relates to, any thoughts about trying to convene some meetings with some other representative utilities to talk about this more globally?
So we have been talking on the project in Boston State. We're dealing with that project. So again, we'd love to underground all the utilities throughout the city. It is a lengthy process. Fortunately, with Comcast here, it's much simpler. There's not a lot of infrastructure that goes underground as opposed to dealing with someone like Eversource. But yes, we do.
I'm just going to put out there, I wonder if it would be appropriate, because we've been doing this with the Double Poles group, which has been fairly successful in reducing the number of double poles, but I wonder if you could try to convene some sort of group to work on that as a kind of a long-term project. I think a lot of it will just involve discussion.
Yeah, no, I agree. We'll be including that in our upcoming roads working group also.
Could I ask
you something? Thank you,
Commissioner. Yeah, I don't know if you've noticed, the Comcast is all over the city sending new cable.
Correct.
And so while there must be a reason why these particular places have to go underground, we're having a whole new cable all over the city. They've been all over. I've gotten several actually called complaints of new lines going across people's houses that they never had before. So it's not quite as good all over the city.
I'm trying to make it good. This is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're looking at new carriers, those type of places. As you are absolutely correct. Comcast in the process of upgrading their entire system. You're actually getting one of the highest levels of services in New England currently. You're the first town that's got this. It has been torturous, to say the least, with the amount of cables that have had to go up to get to there. Then we can start pulling some of the stuff off, some of the older stuff that's up there that no longer is required. That'll be my responsibility for the next 5 years. So as far as you are correct, and I don't want to present that out there, that we're looking to put everything underground, that's right. Not what Comcast is doing. We are looking at specific areas where there could be a backyard pole that's involved in this, it could be something over somebody's property line, somebody's request. Those are the ones we're looking for. If we're going to be there and we have the ability, we'll put it underground. If it's possible. Other stuff, going down one of the main streets, it's just not going to happen simply because everybody else is up in the air, and we wouldn't be able to put out stuff underground.
So I'm going to suggest we have a very if you're giving out your phone number, maybe you could phone number to some other counselors who might like to continue to contact.
So
Mark has moved approval. All in favor? 5-0. Thank you very much. And next is item 396-16, Comcast petition for grant of location on Winter Street, which is Ward 3. And that is the map that is separate in our package.
So, same exact same process. Comcast is requesting to place conduit starting at existing vault on Putnam Street, Trenton Street, 175 feet to existing pole, which is empty on Winthrop Street, placing 1-3 in pipe. We have three corner off that needs to go underground there in service. It just happens to be that these two locations work for us to be able to go underground.
Okay. Any questions on the Winthrop Street site? Barbara?
Is it a new service going on Winthrop or Putnam?
So it's new piping. So but it's not new syrup.
But not new syrup.
Correct. If you followed that a little further down, and there is a, we call it the White House. It's a house up on a hill.
On Winthrop or on Patton?
No, it's actually down the road about 3 blocks from there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a pole line that runs along the back of their property. They're requesting that to be gone. Verizon has already moved their pole. Actually, the electric has already moved theirs. They're petitioning with Verizon to remove theirs. I'm trying to get ahead of the game and have all my stuff in order. So when Verizon moves, I can move it easily. So this is going to be the pathway underground to get rid of that pole.
Oh.
So once that pole, once this is in place, I can run my fibers through here and eliminate that pole on that customer's property. And I don't want to give the customer's name out. I don't know if that's possible. Yeah, I don't want to get involved with that. But she has a pole. They have a pole that is being asked to be removed. We know we have no reason to be there. Electric company's already moved their stuff. Verizon's fighting it. Once Verizon's completed and moved their stuff, whether they do, we're moving next. And I, plus RTN, by the way, will also move. But I'm just trying to get ahead of the game.
Wow.
To get it out of the way.
Okay.
Anything else? Is there anyone here to speak for or against this petition?
Seeing none. Mr. Verna. Putnam Street and Winthrop Street were paved in 2012, so within the 5-year moratorium, so they're welcome to put their conduit in, but there's a million overlaying 25 feet curb to curb the entire length, but plus you'll be using the control down.
Yes, and we're familiar with that, so it will most likely, you know the company will most likely be early. So when they pull the permit, they'll make sure that that's all part of it.
And you have this specific
And it's already conditioned as such.
Yeah.
We don't need to add
anything.
Yeah, already in engineering. Okay. With that, thank you. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Okay. Move to approval by Chairman Bucall Glazer. All in favor, 5-0. Thank you very much.
Right.
And have a good evening.
Thank you.
Excellent.
I'll see you next month.
Thank you.
Rick wanted to join us.
Okay. Do you want to... What I'm going to do with the next several items is there's an overview that I'd like to present from the subcommittee on wireless communications attachments. And then, I'd like to sort of provide an overview of the work that we've done that involves Susan and Cheryl, Alan Mandel. And I don't think there's anyone else here tonight who was involved in it, but it also involved other members of the law department, most regularly Rita Young, sometimes Donald and Kahn, regularly Don Daglian from the engineering department, and Joe Mulvey from IT. So, as you know, we had several meetings already before. We had a sort of an open discussion last month to understand the work that we were doing. This, we had one more meeting at the committee's request to dig a little deeper, to understand a little better the limits of our authority, which I'm going to go into in just as an overview in a second. Then I would like to read take up all three petitions in light of some of the, at least how we understand this could work today. Our focus today is on the petitions that are in front of us, in particular the several that were extended by something called a tolling agreement, the name of which does make no sense to me. And this is the last opportunity we will have to vote on that within the limits of that time frame. So we must vote on it one way or another tonight. So that it can go to full council and be voted before the end of the month. So that's our focus tonight, but the committee has worked diligently, and I will say it's not easy material to digest, and that's a kind way of putting it. It's complicated, it's dense, there's layers of rules. And, of course, all of this is, as we're looking at all this stuff, we're thinking about the visual and other practical impacts on our community that we would like to have more control over. So in your packets, I'm going to use this document to do this overview, and I really am not going to take very long, but in your packets was a PowerPoint from Salem Mass, mm-hmm. who is a bit ahead of us in thinking through this issue. They already have a draft ordinance that we're going to dig into and have taken a look at. But they did this quick PowerPoint, and on page 2 of it, I just want to use this because it says two issues for the city to consider, and what it is about is there's a different set of rules and eventually you have different sets of guidelines and maybe an ordinance to define what we may consider when the petitioner is asking to occupy the public right-of-way. It doesn't matter who owns the pole or whatever the device is that they're attaching to in the public way. But when, and that's on this page too, the other is to attach facilities to municipally owned property, which is not before us tonight, so I won't, it's a different set of rules, but I won't go into it. So we can actually attach conditions to cases where the petitioner wants to attach wireless devices within the public right-of-way. We already have an ordinance that describes some conditions, but it really is not about these kinds of smaller and more voluminous, many of them, wireless attachments. So then they say, well, I'm going to go to the next page of this thing. So the right to occupy the public right-of-way is given to these companies by federal law, but we do have some authority to manage the use and placement of these facilities. So that was going to be our focus. And the other thing we're not doing yet, but we definitely want to be considering, is that we have the right to manage the public right-of-way, also to obtain fees, filing fees. It has to, as it says here, has to be a non-discriminatory and neutral basis, so we must establish the fees, which is very clear in the Salem Ordinance, for example. They established a $500 filing fee for attachments within the public right-of-way. So when Alan gave us the memo earlier in November, he made it clear that although we have the ability to set guidelines and conditions and initial placement of wireless attachments, in no case can we condition it so that it's impossible for the carrier to provide continuous and sufficiently substantial service to serve their customer base. That's a really difficult thing for us to be able to gauge, even with all of the dense materials we've been given by the petitioner. You know, we don't have the expertise to understand the need for that. On the other hand, we know that there are areas within the city that Verizon Wireless serves, such as the area around LaSalle College, and the city has asked Verizon to provide more coverage in that area, for example. And we know that all of our constituents want coverage. So, long story shorter, this memo that Alan provided us, let's see, when was this? Written September 6th, actually has much of this stuff in it, but we distilled it and added to it to create this large type two-page list in the packet. And I'm going to read through two phrases. So, one, this is a typical thing that the petitioner would submit a letter or license from the owner of the utility pole authorizing the
very end of the agenda.
Yeah. It might be in a separate document.
I didn't.
Let's see.
This was in a separate document. And then this one with the.
This one?
It has a cover letter.
With the PowerPoint.
Oh, with the PowerPoint. Oh. Yeah, with the PowerPoint. It's behind the PowerPoint. Okay. But you might want to actually be looking at it as well because it's.
All right, I got it. Yep. Sorry.
There's
about
a number of items.
All right.
Wait a minute. So there's a number of items, and there's key phrases. So I'm only going to go through key phrases. I'm not going to read the whole thing, obviously. So getting a letter or license from the owner of the utility pole authorizing the use of the pole needs to happen before they get terminated. We don't need to condition that. Here are the things we thought of, that we don't want these wireless attachments to include any lighting or any kind of blinking lights that might be disturbing to residents. Because most of these public ways, by the way, of course, are going to be in primarily residential or sometimes, I guess, like commercial areas. They should comply with any applicable city noise ordinance, including buffering sound if the device were to produce an annoying humming or whatever over time. We talked about the color, which is something we can bring up in each of the cases that are before us, but that for the most part we wanted colors that would blend in with the item that it's attaching to so that it would be less visible. We felt strongly that they should not project over the public roadway or sidewalk beyond the berm or curb or otherwise interfere with public use of public way. And that's actually important to say, we think, because of this business of when you create a base station, which is something else we're going to talk about, but if you're creating a base station and no further review is required, the FCC rules that apply in that case allow even much larger installations. The envelope within which they would allow, I don't even think could work because they allow the thing to project 6 feet in every direction. I don't think you could put that much stuff on a pole, but basically they're given carte blanche. So I think this idea of not projecting over the public roadway or sidewalk seems important to us.
So can I just ask a question? Are we allowed to condition it even on the federal?
Well, we would like to have agreement on the conditions that we put forward. If we condition it to the point where, and this was the important point in Alan's memo and in the basic materials, if we have limited authority, and if we condition something to a point where not only could they not put their equipment in that location, but there wouldn't be a location, an approximate location that would allow them to provide the continuous and dense enough coverage, then if they can prove that, which would involve specialists and so forth to go back and forth to moderate a conversation or go to court. So we're not wanting to do that. Let me just read through the list, and then we'll look at this stuff. None of this stuff is doing any of the things that we're talking about at this point, but that they shall not interfere with the operation and maintenance of existing facilities attached to the pole. That street lights, in particular, we sometimes have city street lights on poles in the public way that are not owned by us, that they shall not be moved, or if they need to be removed and replaced, they'll be put back in the same location. That of course, there's some caveats here that involves our relationship with the pole owner. And that signs, we're thinking of street signs, no parking signs, speed signs, and whatever that might be on poles shall not be moved without prior written consent. And here's where we get into the business of creating the base station, that we want to limit the attachments specifically identified in the grant of location to the dimensions and quantity and specifics of the stuff that's being added now, and that further attachments would be subject to prior review and approval by the council. That's the condition that we've asked this petitioner to consider. By the way, these things have been raised and discussed between Alan and the petitioner, so it's not news tonight to anyone. As built drawings, complying with FCC, greater frequency rules,
any other city code. Performance bonds, we actually have language in our ordinance requiring a performance bond for this type of work of $10,000. It's something we might want to further consider in light of specifics, but that's already in our code. Other folks, I want to just raise in that bullet when we're talking about a performance bond, there's also in the Salem ordinance an indemnification clause, which is something you might want to consider. Complying with the National Electrical Safety Code, tags, marks, that sort of thing. Removal of material if we require the removal of the utility pole, et cetera. So that's the list that we came up with. When we go through each of these petitions that are before us, I think I'll pick up the new one first just so we can hear it if there's new folks here. We put this list together so that we could consider each of these locations with respect to these concepts. There's another locational one that we didn't think we could have be a blanket condition, but which we discussed, which is, except for one, the proposed locations before us are on a property line or on a corner or on an island, not directly in front of somebody's house. In one case, it is directly in front of somebody's house. And that's been concerning for us, and that's something that we might want to raise. We did ask for that device to be moved, and I understand the petitioner is here to show us other locations they considered, but essentially why they do not work. That very same location is also on Dudley Road, which is a designated scenic way. Now, designated scenic ways generally apply to things like stone walls and trees and so forth, not utility poles. But it's something that we can discuss. So, are there any questions on that? And, oh, Vicki, since you came in late, going over the material that was provided in the packet, Alan did a lot of work on putting together, but so that we could discuss this petition with respect to conditions and items of concern and distill it to things that are relevant to and as objective as we could. Mm-hmm. So if we can vote, you all are free to vote any way you wish tonight, but Alan and the law department have stressed that if you are inclined to vote against this, or even abstain as it goes into the city council, if you can be as specific as possible to the reasons of your abstention, general statements, you don't like it, you're unhappy with the whole idea of the technology, aren't going to be sufficient to stand up in court. We hope it never gets to that point, but that we really need to have a solid basis for our decision. I want to make that clear at the outset. Any questions on any of that? Mark?
So, are you suggesting, Alan, that we take the petitioner at their word that they need this, and ergo we have to approve it?
No, I'm not.
We're
going to
see what they have to say.
Right.
Yeah, what I would like to add is the conditions that Deborah those would argue that they all fall within the authority of the council under state law. They all directly relate to the kinds of standards that the council can consider in the location, the height, the number of attachments, the set of considerations, and we're dealing with locations that are residential in nature. In one case, there's a scenic road. There's limited frontage, I think, as the pictures indicate. The poles are also close to sidewalks and streets. There's different attachments on these poles. getting too light in some cases. And of course, there's a need for poll under authorization to attach to a specific poll. I don't think any of them would interfere with the ability of the applicant to offer service.
Right, with the exception of the location of the particular poll that we're concerned about.
Yeah, I'm not in a position to evaluate whether they, well, first of all, is there anything that we're asking that could conceivably effectively prohibit the applicant from providing wireless service?
All right, but the case one, the case one.
If it does, then they come in with their case explaining why they need this location.
Before you respond, thank you. Before you respond, what I'd like to do is hear from the petitioner. So, because their rationale for why they chose this location versus a half a dozen others may or may not answer your concerns. I don't know, but I think we should hear it first.
Which one of the original documents?
I'd like to hear each one and then take them up as a group in conversation, and then we have to vote them separately, of course.
I just want to make sure that when we discuss this, because two of them we found, at least two of them, you have to replace the pole. So we wanted to understand what that means. Will there be a double pole situation? And if you could incorporate that into the presentation.
I'd really like to hear the justification for adding this stuff onto our poles as opposed to putting it elsewhere. And what efforts, if any, is made to talk to all the other wireless carriers to see if they can coordinate so we're not going to have four wireless carriers coming in asking for the exact same relief.
Over there, or
whoever,
Do you want to try to answer generally? Or
I have something prepared for the specific questions that Alan and I have been discussing over the past couple of months. With regards to the very basic questions of why do we need to go on these particular polls and locations, we have had people in from C-squared submit video frequency affidavits for each of the three sites. Not the 7 months, that's the other site for now. Mr. Dalton was here and at the September hearing, I believe, and we questioned him at length, and he provided answers. So I think he's made our case as to why we would see any particular case for the RF affidavit for further discussion, but we provided those, we explained the U.S. questions, and I guess I'd rest on those once you have general questions about those. I wasn't aware that we were going to be going over that same ground in detail again, since we've already had Mr.
There was a specific request, I understood, that got to you about what other polls had to
do. Right, and that's a different question.
That's a different question.
Yes, that's a question of what sort of an alternative site analysis could be.
Okay, right. I just wanted to make that decision.
And I addressed that in the letter that I provided on Monday, along with providing the underlying documentation that our site advocacy consultants prepare when they go
I'll agree with you that we did have the conversation about why poles versus towers and versus, you know, other larger types of facilities. But what we didn't do was talk about why do these particular poles have to be in these particular locations, and especially the one we're concerned about, which is right there, So, with that, I need to read these items into the record. And so, Vicki, can you hold on to this? Okay. And then, if you could put them up one at a time. Is that how your presentation runs? Is it according to the...
I actually was really just going to touch on the key issues that I ended up with. One being the alternative site analysis, and I actually got Andrew Whalen and stuff to consult and do
for the petition in turn.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So
then I am going to take up the two in Ward 8 that we previously took up first then, which is 249-16, cell phone petition for grant of location for wireless communications equipment on Dudley Road near 530 Dudley Road, and at Hay Road near 16 Hay Road. So this is a continuation of that public hearing. Are we all set?
Can I ask a question?
What?
Afternoon. Yes, ma'am.
Is this about what we're doing, or?
I'll wait.
Okay, thank you.
What are your instructions of my colleagues from Ward 6?
And just so that the public knows, I know a lot of you are here about one or several of these petitions. We're going to pick up each one and hear the presentation, and then, of course, we're going to the public hearing is continued, but we reopen it so I can hear from you as well, so we can all hear from you as well. How are we doing?
Okay, my turn.
Is it about where we're going?
Okay. It's a general question. My question, I was here when the engineer, I don't recall what his name was, gave his presentation. And I remember he talked a lot about the safety of this and how we didn't have to worry about people's pacemakers and that they were generally safe, which is fine. That's good to hear. What I'm not clear on is an answer to Alderman to Councilor Laredo's question about whether these locations, these specific locations, are required.
That's part of the presentation. With respect to each one of these grants of location.
Okay. Sorry, I came in late.
This is a general question about why do we have to have the technology at all. We've really kind of covered that.
But it's in these locations.
Well, we had a new piece of information. From the information you provided to us, that Steve from the SSCC director, about the creation of the 5G, they're all part of the new 5G network.
They will be part of that when it is actually up and running with the agency. Yes.
No, but that had implications for what we can expect to be happening over the next several months and years.
That is true, but that's not before you know.
No, but it's the beginning of it.
Right, but I fully understand that. But I guess I'm concerned, and I'm just going to put this out there right now, that we've already had two hearings on the application. That's two applications that we've got. Mr. Noyd, who is here, and provided his testimony with regard to why we hold from an RF coverage point of view. Mm-hmm. I don't intend to go over that same ground again this evening. If that's a problem, we should continue this, and I can bring it back.
I don't know if we do that. We need to know why the alternative starts.
Right, and so that right. That was a part of this stuff.
I have a question for the chair.
Okay.
As I read the petitioner's memorandum,
uh-huh.
they're obligated to demonstrate a significant gap in substantial coverage, and that the proposed site is the most feasible alternative to address the aforementioned gap in coverage. That's their burden of proof.
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay. What, if any, study are we doing to look at that, other than to take them at their word that says this is a great plan, we want to put it all over the place? Where's our
consultant? Yeah, we talked about it, and we're talking about that in committee. Alan's reaching out to someone, and Joe Mulvey is reaching out to someone. We don't have that, though. We're behind.
But I can't. I am not comfortable voting on something when it's any petition. I'm not disputing your good intentions. But any petitioner comes to us and says, here's what I want. It happens in land use step all the time, okay? They come in and say, don't worry about the traffic. Don't worry about the parking. And what do? We made them go on hire peer reviewers. So we have none of that here.
What we don't know yet, because I asked Alan this today, is whether or not we can ask for, I mean, you have your own specialist, whether or not we can ask for Verizon Wireless to pay for a peer reviewer that reviews their material who we hire. It's a different set of laws that govern this. You may know the answer to this. I don't.
There is, you know, there's a state law that's specifically tied into zoning that allows for that, and it's something that could be reviewed in a specific site, but I have them boil around to that. But I believe that there's a way to do that. And I'm concerned, and obviously, I'll be blunt, I don't want this team to vote to deny these, and I don't want you to make recommendations to the council to deny these. So, you know, to the extent that you do, having a peer reviewer, something you need to do, perhaps that's something you need to do. Especially if you're not feeling satisfied that you understand that part of it, because, you know, as I said, Mr. Blunty's system is adopted, if you've sort of gone through that. And I don't want to get overly legalistic, because I think I sort of handled this point home before, but I guess I will say it again just to be clear. The standard that you're applying here is not this is that the federal telecommunications, It's not the federal telecommunications act 1996 standard. If the city council votes to deny the petition and we take the city council to court, to federal court under the CCA, to challenge that denial, those denials, then the court will look at whether there's substantial gap in coverage and whether we look at all the alternatives. We do it just so that we can sort of lay the belt and say, hey, we've got our case, we've shown you, we're good. The standard that applies here is Chapter 166, Section 21 and 22, the Grant Allocation Standard, which we've been discussing.
Mm-hmm.
That is the standard that this committee and the city council are bound to apply, and Section 23, 21, the wires and poles, the city ordinance section is from which the indemnification and performance bond and all that comes. That's abuse. Those are the standards that must be applied here. We provide further information in the context of this is a telecommunications act matter, or could be telecommunications act litigation. Ultimately, we don't really want to go there either. But really, what is before this committee and before the city council is a grant location other than to approve a grant location petition under Chapter 166, Section 21, 22, and 25A.
I understand what you're saying here. What I'm trying to understand, and I'm not doubting the need for wireless technology to enable all of us to use our phones and other wireless devices. I get that. But your client is coming in and saying, I've done a study, and this is what I want to do. Okay, fine. And this is very significant for us because the implications here are huge. Once you're on these poles, we're done. We've lost most of our control.
But if I may, there, and Ellen and I discussed this, and we're prepared to do exactly what Verizon Wireless did with the city of Boston. I don't look, you have the language, and I actually have it on my computer, but I can't get it there. The city of Boston and Verizon Wireless agreed to this specific unit this past spring that had filed stuff up in a $200 million huge thing that included both the rollout of files in certain Boston neighborhoods and then also small cell attachments throughout the downtown Boston area. And I'm not sure if it goes out into West Australia or something like that. But a whole major focus of this agreement was small cell attachments, so facilitating the attachment of wireless and antennas and supporting equipment to city-owned and non-city-owned light poles and utility poles in Boston. And one thing that Verizon expressly agreed to, although, as I totally conceded, technically, legally speaking, if you allow an antenna, a wireless antenna on a utility pole, you are, in fact, legally speaking, creating an existing base station. Verizon Wireless is going to say, as it said to Boston, we're just going to say, we're not going to treat this as an existing base station. Now, as for other carriers, we can't find other carriers. But other carriers will have to come before this committee and the city council, file their application petition, and at that point, you can look at it and say, well,
So why aren't we, Madam Chair, why aren't we talking far more holistically here? I mean, I'm just incredibly uncomfortable with this ad hoc, one location, other location.
We are
doing it
holistically, but we can't catch up to the time frames. There's a shot clock provision in the law.
I know you're preventing from withdrawing a petition or tolling.
There isn't. We've already done an extension of this particular one. So, that's what I'd like to do. Maybe we will get agreement that we will postpone it again if, for example, what is that issue here is that we need to get a consultant and we do have an ability to do that, perhaps even on Verizon Wireless Dime. If that is how the law reads. But I still would like to hear from the petitioner the presentations that are prepared to give us tonight on each one of these petitions so that we will have that in mind as we move forward. How's that? Okay?
Whatever you want.
Is your question?
Well, just to add to what Mark has said, in land use, the way we do this is that when we have a substantial development that's coming in, we do require the petitioner to pay for certain studies. And those studies enable us to see a third-party opinion on whether, in fact, what the developer is saying is the case. And I think that would make us a whole lot more comfortable here if we could do that. We're not saying that we don't want in the future to have capacity to do all the electronics and cell operations that we know are going to be increasing over the years. We need to have some idea, since this is a big step for the city, that what you're saying is in fact the case.
And I fully understand that. If I can also throw in, and this is maybe part of our presentation too, but in the conditions that the wireless subcommittee came up with, and then that Alan forwarded to me that I sent him back sort of wordsmithing on, but generally completely agreed. I mean, Verizon Wireless, with respect to the timing of the telecasting licenses, which other towns, and the telecasting licenses that are required from the toll owners, and basically Eversource getting. Getting actual documentation out of Eversource is like pulling teeth. It's ridiculous. It takes a very long time.
In Salem.
How did they do it in Salem? I'm sure that they just waited a year to get their telecasting licenses. But what other towns have done, and what the Massachusetts Department of Transportation has also agreed to, is that grant conditioning the grant location on the receipt of the telecasting licenses prior to actual installation of the attachment on the pole. So that would be the only thing that we really would be like, oh yeah, we'd like to be able to keep our process moving forward from sort of a budgeting point of view and all of that. And then if we don't have the attachment license in hand from the pole owner,
okay.
Then go forward.
Okay. Let's please go forward with the presentation on this petition, and then we'll hold that one and we'll go to the next one, etc. Okay.
All right.
Are you unable to get your...
I currently have there, and part of...
Do you happen to have it on a flash drive?
I have most of it, but not all of it on the flash
drive. Oh. Okay, I'm just going to, while you're fixing there, I didn't officially recognize Vicki Janberg, Pamphlet Large from Ward 6, and we've been joined by President Lennon, Pamphlet Large from Ward 1. And just to, we are waiting for technology, or we may have to go ahead with a presentation without technology. We have reviewed the conditions that the subcommittee came up with. You haven't had a chance to look at them in your packet, and I'll leave this list here.
And
it would have been an email as well.
So while they're figuring it out, are there any thoughts? I was sitting out there for a while. By the way, we've also been joined by Councilor Ruthann Four at large from Ward 7, Councilor Brian Yates at large from Ward 5, and Councilor Rick Whitlock at large from Ward 8. And for the let me just summarize where we are then for everyone who's just coming into the room. Elizabeth Mason is obviously joining us again from Verizon Wireless. She is prepared to give us a presentation on each one of the petitions, those we have heard and those we have not heard yet. But in particular, on those we have heard, there's concern about one of them, one of the locations, which is directly in front of somebody's house, although there's lots of vegetation and so forth, it is right smack in front, and it's on a scenic way. So we asked about alternative locations, and they have prepared something that is going to tell us whatever half dozen other locations they've considered and why they don't work, and so why they need this particular location in order to provide the continuity of service that they have a right to provide. I'll also say while we're waiting that the conditions that we've enumerated so far are acceptable to the Verizon Wireless, and we also learned an important piece of information which might at the other end of this evening's conversation get us to agree to hold this further, because Ms. Mason said that the law does provide for us to hire a peer reviewer of the whatever it is, combination of telecommunications science and so forth, that it will establish that indeed this is, these are the locations they need in order to provide that service. Which is not something we knew we could do. Alan?
In the zoning context, I am familiar with the peer review concept, and usually there's some specific authority for that. There's something similar to that with the grant location statute. So
okay.
I have seen ordinances from other parts of the country that may include that, but of course, ordinances that don't. But it would have to be, it would have to be some legal authority basis for asking the applicant to do that.
From our own law or from a state law?
Oh, under state law.
Chapter 166 says that there is a, I believe it's freestanding. I don't think it ties specifically into, I've seen many zoning bylaws and ordinances that say
So maybe I could ask a question then. Are you willing to do that so that we can get to the bottom of this for these petitions, whether or not there's the legal, precise legal connection between the several laws?
I was hoping to have this part done by 8:30.
Yeah, I apologize.
This is actually where we're editing.
Actually, okay. These are essentially ends up being the same folks, more or less. So,
we receive a search area from Verizon Wireless, a radio frequency engineer, their RF engineer. And they basically give us a point on a map, usually Google Maps expert that looks similar to this. Our job is then to find poles near where that point was and try to find poles that will fit within EverSource's regulations and clear the circuit between Verizon and EverSource. EverSource is a circuit partner that we work with. So this has to be RF engineers. They come back with us and they connect with us and say, this is our primary candidate. We want to move ahead with this one. This is the best candidate for the network. We go out and create drawings. We then get those drawings approved by RF and then apply to utilities, Verizon and EverSource in this case.
So did you look at alternatives?
Yes, so we, for instance, for this site, went up and down the street. Basically, the what RF gave us was a point close to where our primary candidate was. We went up and down and found candidates that would work and submitted them in the SCIF site candidate information package.
Can you tell us why the other polls didn't work?
So a lot of this is down to
our engineer's preference. Yeah. Is this preference? Let me just interject. Is it preference or is it required?
No, it is a requirement.
That's not the word you just used.
Let me rephrase it.
Probably a good idea.
It is a, it's his job to do what's that to the net. And he has alternatives like in any power analysis, there are alternatives.
Well, we understand that's the best, but we ask for alternatives that may not be in front of someone.
And in depth of the network, what else does he take into consideration?
Yeah.
On the other slide, for example, it said some poles had a transformer, some poles had
those were the purpose of those.
Can we get some answers to some of the questions that we've heard?
Maybe I'll try to rephrase if I may. Madam Chair.
Go ahead. And then give them a chance to answer.
You know, good class examination. You don't do that. I'll try my best. I'm sorry. Maybe you can help us out a little bit here. You said the RF engineer has a preference for one particular place. And I understand that. Are there other locations, however, that would have been acceptable, even if not a first choice?
Depending on the site, it's conceivable that there would be other alternatives. But
are there?
In this particular case?
Yes, these are the alternatives that they considered. These alternatives ruled out either because they didn't have fiber running through them, or EverSource was not willing to license those poles because they had other equipment on them, and just as the other slides are that I can show you, whether it was in one case you saw the other slides, there was a telecommunications equipment. There were transformers on two of them. In fact, there's a transformer right in front of somebody's house that's more prominent than our attachment would be in front of. I see the frustration on your face, but I see that we're not going to be able to get anywhere this evening, I don't think.
I'm just trying to follow up on the question. I understand that you've looked at several other locations.
Correct. For
each of those locations, you deemed them unacceptable because you couldn't get the requisite approval. I get that.
Yes.
But the starting point was locations which your RF engineer said,
right.
Yes, were there other locations that might not have been quite as good from a service perspective, but would have been better from an aesthetic perspective?
That's a question that I can't really answer the way you phrased it. What our RF engineers do, and not Mr. Valenti, who is a consultant, comes in from the beginning and says, I run it for my own software and I do this for Verizon engineers, this is what we do. What the Verizon engineers do is they take all the information, they put it through their own software, they generate the search ring.
It doesn't look like a ring, by the way. I know, it's not. It actually has a ring. That is the Google flag in a spot. Yeah, but it's not a ring. It's like there are other. It's not a Google flag. It's a very small, low-power site. This is really, it's not in the expansive area like the 100 gigs foot level power, but there are other poles. I think what Andrew meant by preference is, essentially, the software, the modeling software that the Verizon RF engineers uses, has
generated the search ring in a certain area that is the area that the network improvement is intended to address. That's what they're targeting. It's AT&T called it the targeted coverage area. That's where they're, that's where we're trying to meet or improve the coverage or capacity shortfall.
Which you said doesn't necessarily, isn't in this area, it could be in another area.
So
we're only looking at
one. No, right. But this area, the people don't seem to have a problem with service in this area. When he discussed it, he was talking about with Roxbury or bouncing off the tower.
This particular site is covering both in this area and then also it will offload. And again, this is where it may be helpful to, once you have your own RF engineer. It's very hard to talk about one without the other because it's each site. Whether you're talking about a 150-foot tower or one of these utility pole sites, you're talking about will that site at that height be the coverage you're looking for and the offloading of capacity you're looking for? Is that site available? Is it, you know, if it's a tower, if the guy wants the field, you know, let's lease you the land to build it on. Or here, is Eversource going to look at that pole and say, well, whether or not we replace it, it's already got these things on it, so yeah, we can't do that one, it's just not available. And then there's the question of, is there Verizon fiber running to the pole? Because that is necessary for the backhaul component. So at least those two boxes need to be checked.
So there is something. So, can I get an answer? Can I see if I can rephrase or get an answer to my question, which was, in addition to the considerations that you've outlined, are there other things that you look at? Like, do you look at any aesthetic considerations? Do you look at any neighborhood considerations?
Well, I would say, generally speaking, this whole program is designed, this whole small cell rollout is designed to these antennas look like, and the spring things look like attachments that are already on the poles in front of all of your houses or right down the street from all of your houses. And I can flip back to the other file to show you that there are far larger and more obnoxious Eversource transformer canisters on a pole right up the street from the subject.
This is a picture of the pole.
Yeah,
it has a transformer on it.
That's not the pole that we're proposing to go on. That's the pole up the street.
And so it's the one right in front of us. That looks like the house.
It's not. No, it's not. Right in front of the house. That's not your pole? That's your pole number on it. You can check the number. The number, I just was with the address. So here's what I had up for. So there's nothing on this pole now. I think that what you just showed me is this one, which is, you know, this is a hot kid that jumped there, but it is there. When you drive, when you put on the scene, there's that, and you're like, bam, there's that pole number.
So that's not.
Ours is going to be so much fun to include in that it's not even funny. Which is, do you think you can have aesthetics? You know, generally speaking, in this program of rolling out these small cell attachments for Verizon Wireless, it's been very careful to design them to be stealth, to look like, or to look
as bad as or less bad than anything else that is already on any municipality's utility poles. And I can run through the pictures if you want.
Please, let me complete the presentation. I think we got hung up in some of the language you used, which maybe needed to be a little more careful. But what I think I understand, if I could summarize, is that of these four poles, all of which would work by location, the only one that is allowing you to put the equipment on is the locust pole.
That is correct.
Okay.
Right. So, from a public point of view, it's likely that any of them could work. But beyond that, from the fiber and from the actual, will ever source let us go on this pole. And, you know, even if they move stuff around or put in a replacement pole, because, and I'm speaking from theoretically, say the pole that we're looking to go on was a little bit bent, they might want to replace that from a structural point of view, because as part of their process, they go through a pre-construction survey, and they do a structural analysis. And if it's not going to pass the structural analysis, we don't need to go that far.
That's good to hear, because that was some of our earlier questions.
Absolutely.
Does the pole need to be straight?
You know, actually, they apparently don't need to be straight.
No, they allow a certain curvature. I actually have that.
But if you want to walk through this for example, this is sort of a general, we don't have to go through all four segments, but this one is really very demonstrative of
folks,
this
one
question.
So is that the pole you photographed, Cheryl, with the transformer?
Yeah.
Okay, so that apparently is not the pole they're proposing.
It's right in front of them, good.
Because it's one of the ones they considered but may not be used. It has nothing on it.
We looked at it and it has no transformer on it. So basically Verizon gets to decide if they get to use and then we're stuck with it.
Verizon or EverSource, whoever owns the pole, has their own set of rules.
Even though they're using a pole in our public way.
But so is EverSource and Verizon Telephone, and everybody else, we're giving them the right to put a pole up there,
and now they're essentially dictating what goes in what place.
Well, this is not the one, is it? No, this is one that is rejected because of the transformer, right? Oh, it is the one you want to do. I apologize because if I could have put that on the computer, I would have put it on extremely poorly. So I wouldn't be able to show you, here's pole on the transformer, which is the one that's just to the north of pole room. This is just up the street to the north. I think they might have just had solar panels on their roof. That's another view of that same pole, which is, I believe, the one you have a picture of. So
no, why doesn't have the doesn't have a streetlight on it? You have the one you want to use to give a picture of
those. I actually have it all here, picked out, and I was going to bring it out to everybody, but since I was told not to do that, like going away last time, I did not. But okay, this is not going to be very helpful.
So what does the pole that you want to use have on it right now? Nothing.
Just wires. Nothing at all.
These are pictures of the transformer that is on the pole.
Probably
the one I have up,
and I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
This is
can't see what's happening.
Okay, this is the one that's one seat up, this one is one down.
You wanna show that?
And this is further down the street, just that box.
And it has to be on Dudgeon Road. There wasn't even another Dudgeon Road.
Well, again, it goes back to their engineering algorithms, and we have never looked at or examined, and we don't know what goes in. And what you produce depends on the criteria.
Folks, we've got to bring some order to this. So we're passing around pictures. We have a picture up on the screen. Here's what I heard. We have four poles that Verizon Wireless was able to consider within the area that would serve this coverage matter.
Yes.
There's only four. There's not any more than that.
Correct.
Of the four, you're telling us that although by location, any one of them would have served this coverage need, three of them don't work because they have other equipment on them or too many wires or whatever the standards for installation are, don't work for your equipment to be attached to any of those other three poles.
And EverServe would not, and they don't have permanent license.
Right.
Exactly.
Because of
their standard license,
they won't get on the poles.
That's correct. And those, as Evan said, and as I would have shown you, they're lengthy and complicated.
I understand.
Motion to hold until we have our expert.
I call it as advisory question, but I think that would be helpful because it really is a holistic discussion.
We really have to
discuss it. Yeah, it would be extremely helpful, and that way I'll bring Mr. Valenti back. They can talk.
More globally, what is their plan? Because you're under a certain set of criteria, you're coming to the conclusion that you could only have one of four locations. I understand how you eliminated it through, that makes perfect sense. But it's how you get to that earlier decision of these are the only places we could do it that I think warrants a much closer examination, because clearly they're relying on some kind of algorithm format way above my pay grade, never understand how they do it, but obviously they're feeding certain criteria into it.
And
if you change those criteria too strict, you might have come to some very different conclusions about what you need and where you put things. And so that seems to be what you got to examine.
I'm not, at least I'm not,
capable of making those decisions. So you may be exactly right. I just don't know.
I respect that, coming into the algorithm level of things, I don't know either. So that's why I rely on Verizon's own RF engineers and consultants for the ICT to make that case.
On the motion to hold, I also want to, when we're talking about the consultants, and I remember this from the radio tower discussion several years ago, it would be good to, I know you want to give him some options, but we need to find a consultant who does not usually make his money from these companies.
And there are folks out there,
yep.
Some more credible, some less.
Thank you.
Do that morning.
Okay. So before we move hold, I need to ask how many people are here on either the Dudley Road or Hay Road petition. Okay. So I'm going to give you time to speak if you like, but I'm going to suggest at the same time that you understand that we're holding this until we get much more information. So if you are content to wait and speak your piece, because I know we heard from all of you a month ago or 2 months ago, that would be terrific so that we could move through the rest of this agenda. But I'm opening the public hearing. If you have something burning that you must tell us.
Eric Thompson, Dudley. Mm-hmm. I'm following what Mark is saying. I was always told to say there were four poles that can be used. Okay? If Verizon moves fiber, they can put fiber anywhere in any pole. In a lot of areas, you have Skyline Park, you have Baltic Road. I think the most important factor in in the way the system will work.
Well,
okay.
When you're talking about natural itself, yeah.
Okay. And sure, there are other alternatives to supplement
here. Okay. Thank you. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on these two.
Before you do,
before
you
do. Continue the public hearing. So, just a second.
Wait, you want to say
something? So, you want to say something to me? Okay, go ahead.
First, I'm glad you're going to do a study and bring in somebody independent. I heard another town recently did that, but they have a smart move. But the other concern here is the whole curve there and it protruding into the road. And I'll give you an example. Capital got the pole across, directly across, and this is on property on the end there, where the mirror was, that the engineer, the Newton, asked. It's been replaced four times now because trucks keep hitting it going around the corner of the curb. So I'm just telling you, it really is a treacherous corner of the road if you go around there.
Okay.
And what they're talking about is the whole blind driveway sign. So
okay.
I just want to point out from a safety standpoint, from both installing and maintaining, it's not at the corner.
I'm going to suggest that we ask our transportation folks to have a look at that. That sounds reasonable at that particular condition.
The first we've heard of the entertainment work that that's 533 that way, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I want to clarify, I don't think the pole that they wanted on it is the pole that
it's the one next to it.
Right. Yeah, it's not the pole with the mirror. So it's not that pole that you keep getting hit.
No,
it's
no, it's
pole.
The pole, the one that I was the one that has the sign for the blind drive is the same.
Right. Well, our conditions that we proposed,
the protrusions are de minimis. The condition we proposed was that nothing may protrude outside of the dimension of the berm and the curve, if there is one. And the dimensions of these are far less than that. So I take your point.
And it can't block all my edges.
Right. So are you good for tonight? Thank you. With that, we're going to hold this particular hearing open, and I have a motion to hold this item, and we have work to do. All in favor? It's unanimous. We have 7-0. We're not done yet, though, Elizabeth, because we did advertise these other items. I need to at least take them up to hold them, if that's what we think we're going to do to be consistent. So we have also a public hearing on 281-16, the grant of location for wireless communications equipment at Sargent Street in Ward 7. And do we want to have any discussion on this? Are you ready?
I'd like just move to hold it.
Is there anyone here to speak for or against or in any way on this particular petition? I see none. I'm going to hold that.
I just want to point out that this one happens to be in a traffic island.
Yeah.
It's not in front of any.
No, and I think and that may make it far more acceptable, but again, we're going to have someone look at their plan. I think we ought to just sit tight.
Okay. So we do have a motion to hold on this, and I'm going to leave the public hearing open. All in favor? Unanimous. And then on 4/23/16, we have another petition for wireless communication equipment, 93 Stevlin Road, also in Ward 8. Any comments on this one? I'm thinking we will also hold this as the new one. Okay, so do I have a motion to hold this item from Ward 8? Okay.
Motion to hold. I'm not sure if anybody's near this.
Okay, 7-0. Thank you very much.
Did you have a question, woman?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Can you
state your name for the record?
Jeremy Rasmussen from Deborah
Hudson. Yes.
Looking at that pole, it looks like it's right in front of somebody's house.
This is the one that's on the property line.
Right?
In between.
Is it the right picture here? Right in between two houses?
Yes.
In between two houses right on the property line.
Right in front. Okay.
Well, it is kind of, but
well,
in between.
You see it,
but it actually is.
Okay. And then the second question, it sounds like because there were discussions about impacts of radio frequencies and things like that. And so I guess I just wanted to make sure that the appropriate questions that we asked about the role of representation is going to help how effective people think.
What we have learned is that we, the petitioner has provided us with evidence as they are required to do in a report determining the level of radio frequency emissions at a couple of different heights relative to where the equipment is placed, and those are shown to be far below what is allowed by FCC regulations, and we have no authority to discuss the matter beyond that.
That's very interesting. We should have our consultant look into that.
Well, maybe we could ask Verizon, do these overlap, or do you get them far enough apart so that they don't overlap?
They're not, they're 10 cool.
Yeah. But I don't think they overlap.
Good point.
I don't think they overlap.
There is overlapping to a degree, but to nowhere nearly to the extent that there would need to be. The combined radio frequency emissions are order of magnitude below the maximum physical exposure level that's allowed by the Federal Communications Commission.
Could I ask too, what happens if another company comes in with its own wireless program? Do we again completely foreign to me, but do we add on then to the radio frequency?
What if they're adding on?
With other fixed locations, the various people that have sewer fittings for the frequency emissions have a cap, and they're all responsible for making sure that that cap is not exceeded. That would be similar to the cupola in this building.
So when
you keep the overall general emissions under a certain effect.
So when Verizon
comes on one pole, but when you're talking about poles that are scattered, I don't think there's any legal evidence to look at that. I don't.
Well.
So we could certainly ask the question of our person.
You're coming in and saying our circuits, our system is going to generate an RF below everything else. But when you did that study, did you look at the other RF frequencies that are being generated by other providers at the same time?
No, because we're not on a poll with those providers. What the FCC requires is that you look at the general claim, nerve and catalog, which is like 15%, approximately 50% of the overall maximum exposure level, but that's on a single monopole.
This is so far above my pay grade, I can't imagine. Yeah. But just if you could have the consultants look at this type of question as well, and at least give us some guidance.
Yeah, if there's already somebody on a call, right, and a second and third and fourth.
This is interesting because normally when we talk about poles, we talk about towers,
right,
and that's what the laws were made for.
Exactly.
You can only put a certain things on a tower, so they didn't deal with nearby ones because there weren't. So this is
I'm going to suggest we really need to move on. We have our major roads presentation tonight, and we're at the moment. I want to thank the petitioner for all the work he brought us today. We are holding the public hearings open on all of these items before, okay? So that when, I'm not sure when we're taking them up again, we have to find out about hiring a peer reviewer, and we'll let you know. All right, thank you.
I just wanted to mention that we got this lengthy document with lots of photographs on several of these petitions on the table. It's a lot of paper. I'm going to keep mine because I'm thinking those of us on the subcommittee probably should keep ours. I'm wondering if you would like, to use it and bring it next time, or give it to Nadia so she has to get up here.
Yes,
can you say that? So we are joined at now by Maureen Lemieux, Chief Financial Officer and what else are you? Chief of Staff. And Commissioner McGonigal, would you like to join us, or are you going to be standing? Commissioner McGonigal, Department of Public Works, along with Amy Mark, Director of Operations, Department of Public Works, and is there someone else who's going to be staying on for this as well?
My city engineer, and I want to introduce Conrad Ledger. Conrad is with Beta Engineering. He heads up their pavement management division. They're going to be working closely with us throughout this project, not only in the big document preparation, but also going through tonight some of our strategies for our pavement maintenance and management moving forward.
Let me just say that we're taking this up as a chair's note, but also it's, I have to put in here, it's item 200-15. We threw this in there because we don't have another docket item update on the strategic plan for street and sidewalk improvement. So with that, take us away from wireless cell attachments.
The conversation lasts 3 hours.
Listen, we just want free, okay? We just want to focus on not free. None of this effort.
No wireless. No wireless paper. So Maureen's going to say a few words before we
start. I'm going to be very brief. But I think you all know how much work we've done over the last 7 years. Between the structural deficits and reserves, long-term liabilities, schools, our trees, taking care of those, all of the different things that we've done. Water, sewer, stormwater. We knew that 4 years ago now, when we put the override package together, we knew that we needed to beef up what we were doing for roadways. We added, asked people to give us an extra $1 million. This became very clear to us that even though we were doubling what we were doing, we were never going to catch up with our roads at the rate we were going. So actually, last spring, probably last February or March, the mayor and I started having conversations about what can we really do to make an impact on the roads. And so first Jim came to us and said, this company StreetScan is out there. And they could at least define for us with empirical data what our road conditions really were. And so you have to find how you're going to fix the problem if you don't know how bad the problem is. We all know that. And so we had StreetScan come in, they did all the roads, we worked with them for several months getting ready for the CIP, and had them put together a plan so we understood if in 10 years we wanted to get these roads up to and very good standard, what would it take for an investor? And so we, in October, presented to you our plan, which would have about $9.5 million a year of spending. We then turned around, and after this construction period and we've had issues, which many of you know that in detail, between the water to the stormwater work we've been doing, the paving work we've been doing, the work that Enbridge has been doing, there's only so much that the city can handle. And so we know if we're really going to accelerate this program, we need to figure out how we are going to manage all of this work that we are planning on doing. And so just like we beefed up the public buildings department when we started with the school project, and we hired several project or program managers, just like we're working with Weston and Sampson on all of our water, sewer, and stormwater work, we realized that we needed an engineering firm to partner with us so that we could really plan this appropriately, figure out how we're going to get all of this work done, identify exactly what it is that we need to do. And so again, Jim came to us. So I just want to say, kudos to Jim for coming to us and finding the data, because we were working with them on different other issues. And we know that we can't do this alone. And so we want to be successful in this. So I'm actually thrilled that we're here tonight, even though it's a late start, but that we're here tonight before we all kind of break for the holidays. I want you to really be able to see all the work that DPW has been doing and that we will continue to do. And we're more than happy to, really discuss openly what we think our challenges are over the next several months so that we can really get the ground running, hopefully, if the weather isn't too bad, by mid-April. It would be great if we're out there on the streets and getting to work. So I don't want to take up any time, but I just wanted to kind of set the stage. So we're really excited to be giving you this presentation.
Thanks,
Maureen.
Thank you. Yes, we're going to create a comprehensive pavement management program. We've already begun that. We've talked about street scan. That was gathering our totally objective data. So we have a benchmark that also gave us some groundwork of what we need to fix where. Our current CCI is at 62, the average across the city. So just if you remember, 0 to 100 is the CCI scale, 100 being the new road. Our average across the city is 62. We have some roads that are down near single digits, actually. So again, we really need to look at this in a comprehensive manner. There's that coordination of the utility and the roadway project. As you all know, we're working with National Grid. We meet with them monthly. We meet with Eversource monthly. National Grid has really made great headway, so much so that they asked us this year to come to their yearly meetings that they have with towns and cities. And we had Shane speak about our monthly meetings. They wanted to use us as that poster child because it has been so successful. It's not perfect, as we saw on Haddam Street, but that wasn't in their plan to replace the gas line there. But through our negotiations and working with them, they agreed to do it and put it on their capital plan that wasn't even on there. That's just proof that this is working, and it's just us meeting with them and working together. Try to get through some of that. There's also our internal utilities. We have a large water and sewer cleaning lining replacement program, so it's coordinating that also. We've been working with Conrad recently just to put all that together. So you have the list in the CIP of the roads that we're doing, and that right now is our basis for what we're working on. We're going to see some of that shift as these utility issues come up. We were supposed to pave Chestnut this year, but with the LA Street Bridge closing, we realized, we can't do that. It's part of our detour. We didn't want to impact that area any more than it already was going to be with the bridge being closed. Communication to the community. Again, it's important that we get that out there. We've tried to work better at that this year. It's important. We send out notices. A critical component of this is going to be our betterment process. We saw it this year on one of the streets we did. We had to delay the process because about half the streets came out once they saw the betterments that were going in, decided they wanted them. So it delayed paving 3 weeks. We can't do that anymore. And we sent registered letters to everyone. But still, this is historically, Luke can attest to this, has been happening when he says that. We're not going to be able to address that going forward because our schedule is critical. As Maureen said, the only way we're going to be able to do this is now we're going to start paving in April. This year we didn't start until by the time the contracts are executed, it's August because we don't have funding until July 1st. The way we're rolling out this program is we're going to have funding now. We're working closely with Conrad to get our contracts out in January, so we have early bids out there, hopefully get good contracted, which we feel confident we will, because this is a significant increase. And Conrad does this throughout the Commonwealth, that they're highly recommended in the pavement management program, and he says this is really an aggressive program, and we should do very well during the bid process, which is another reason we want to get this out there early. Another reason for that is the plan. We're going to have to get with police. We're going to have a transportation management plan for detours and things of that nature. You all see the construction that's going on throughout the city. So again, it's part of that construction management. And then the payment and maintenance. We're looking at different methods also, and Conrad's really going to touch on these. There are other methods out there of pavement preservation that we haven't historically used just because we didn't. And there are things that we can do to preserve the life of our streets. What we've been doing in the past, we've been totally reactive. We let our streets go into complete segregation, and we come in and fix them. So we're going to touch on this, and Conrad will touch on this. That's not the approach we should be taking. First, it's not efficient, it's not effective, and it requires us to do major work, and we won't have to be. It won't impact the community as much going forward once we get caught up. This is just a quick chart. Again, our average PCI is 62 throughout the city. 35% of it is less than 55. That's a critical component. That's when our roads are in critical repair. They probably need, you know, reclamation. That's when we're doing that major repair. We don't want our streets to get to that point. So throughout this process, you're going to see it. We're going to get a lot of complaints of, why are you working on that street? You just paved it 5 years ago. Well, the component of that is the maintenance and preserving that street. That's what we haven't been doing. We're letting our streets go into this critical repair mode. So we're going to try to eliminate that going forward. So you will see us working on streets that we haven't been, we may have saved recently. And again, this is the reason why we're doing that, to preserve these streets. So we don't have to come back for 20 years and do a major repair on that. So Conrad, you want to touch on the major?
Sure. So, you said before it was, good there. So just to give you folks a little bit of a background on who I am and what Beta Group does, we're a full-service engineering firm, and one of our major core disciplines is GIS and asset management, more specifically pavement management. We work in over 120 communities throughout New England on mostly pavement management programs. So I do this pretty much all in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. We do have other groups that do it in Connecticut and Rhode Island as well. So today what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through the process of what we're doing and some of the goals and objectives that we've kind of set. I'm also going to walk through some of the treatments that we're proposing to use specifically this year and then years moving forward to preserve the roadways. A lot of them are going to be unfamiliar to a lot of people in the room because they haven't been used in the city a lot. By photos, and I'd like to go through and kind of explain what they are and what they'll do. So first off, what is pavement management? Pavement management is really the practice for planning your pavement maintenance to maximize the life of the roadway network. One of the key components of that is to do the right repair at the right time. So I'll get into that a little bit more as we go along. So this is what we call a pavement deterioration curve. So you can see on the left-hand side here is that PCI value, so that's 0 to 100. So you start out when you repave a roadway in excellent condition up here at 100, and as you go along, this roadway is going to start to deteriorate over time. You can see here in about the 10 to 12 year mark, it starts to drop off very, very quickly, and it'll go down to the bottom of that curve. So what we have the opportunity to do is we have the opportunity to perform pavement preservation techniques along the way. So to kind of extend that life out, so you're not going back as quickly to those roadways to repair. This is what we call our pavement management toolbox. So you have on the left-hand side here, you have a good roadway, and you have all these techniques along the way to get into that bad roadway to do along the way to preserve the life of the roadway. So you can see here the maintenance techniques. That's a little bit better. The maintenance techniques here include crack sealing, fog sealing, and patching. Preservation techniques include microsurfacing, tape sealing, hot in place. And then when you get into your structural repairs, these are the ones that you have to go in and basically rip apart the roadway and build it back together. Lumen overlay, reclamation, and reconstruction. As you go along here as well, the treatments become more expensive as well. So we'll talk about that as well. So first off, I just kind of want to introduce what some of these treatments are and what they look like. So first off, on the left-hand side here, you have crack sealing. you may have seen this being performed in the city. Basically, when the truck goes along, it basically fills in the crack with a rubberized material. So what we're trying to do here is, this is when a roadway is just beginning to crack. One of the most, the things that make a roadway deteriorate the quickest is water. Gets into the crack, freezes, pops out the asphalt, causes all your potholes. So what we're trying to do here with this treatment is we're trying to prevent the water from getting into the crack, getting into the subbase, and deteriorating the roadway very quickly. Any questions on crack seal and why we do it? Okay, fog seal is the next one. So this is one that definitely has not been used here in the city in the past. The fog seal is a spray emulsion that goes on the roadway. I kind of describe it in layman's terms as sealing your driveway on steroids. So this truck goes down the street, you basically spray an emulsion on the roadway, and what you're doing is you're rejuvenating the top surface of the roadway. It'll actually sink in about 3/4 of an inch. And what causes the roadway to crack is two things. One is reflective cracking from the bottom, and then deterioration or oxidation from the top. So what you're trying to do here is before the oxidation starts cracking the roadway and causing that water to get inside, you're rejuvenating that top layer of roadway to make it more flexible so it doesn't crack. So that's kind of an overview of fog seal.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Environmentally, what kind of material is that? And what does it mean?
It's a liquid asphalt. So with a rejuvenating characteristics inside of it. So in terms of, I can't speak to the exact chemical balance of the materials, but I do know that all of this is environmentally more safe than retaining a roadway. So if you want to take
it with the water, okay.
Yeah, no, so they will not apply this when it's raining out. Mm-hmm. We don't want it to run off the roadway, but the key is to get it into the asphalt itself. This is actually part of the mix that asphalt is made with in the first place. So, and it's going to get some rejuvenators inside of it as well.
So is there a cleaning process that has to precede this?
Sure, so basically they say that you have to just make sure the roadway is clean so it gets swept a couple times.
Just sweeping, that's all?
Yes.
So, how deep are the weeds going to get? I have to throw this question out about fog seal. Okay, alright.
Fog
seal somewhat similar to a microsurfacing?
It is not similar to microsurfacing. No, it's not.
What are all the streets you did down in Onanta that I was calling you about 3 years?
That was
microsurfacing.
What is it?
Microsurfacing.
All right,
great. I can't wait.
Oh, well, here you go. any other questions on the treatment?
Okay.
And again, please, feel free to ask questions along the way because I don't want to get too far into it and then people forget.
So the new roadway on Lowell Avenue,
mm-hmm.
The oldest of the new part is starting to crack already. How far do you let a road go before you do the crack seal thing?
The crack seal thing is as soon as we get it to the point where it starts cracking, that's a little bit more considering for crack seal.
Mm-hmm.
Fog seal is actually a great treatment before it starts cracking because you're trying to prevent the cracking in the first
mm-hmm.
place.
Mm-hmm.
But once it starts cracking, you can do a couple different types of treatments or combinations of treatments. You could do a crack seal and then a fog seal on top of it, or you could do a crack seal and a microsurface on top of it, which we haven't gotten to yet. So there's a lot of different combinations to preserve
but
that.
But since you have so many roads, you must have to do some assessment of when you do this first, second, and third, because
yep.
it's happening everywhere.
Absolutely. Yep, and that's part of the tree scan data
yep.
that we're utilizing to give us that information. Any other questions on these two? Okay. So the next two that we're going to talk about are microsurfacing and fake seal. So microsurfacing, as you said, sir, has been used in different parts of the city in the past. So microsurfacing is basically it's about a half inch to a 3/4 inch thick, and it goes down on the existing surface of the roadway. We always suggest that you crack seal first if the roadway is indeed cracking, and then that surface goes on top. So there's a lot of pros and cons to a lot of these different products. And there are a lot of things that I would recommend doing with these products or roadways to do and not to do. And the reason I say that is that right repair at the right time that I talked about first. If you put any of these products on a roadway that shouldn't have that product put on it, it's going to fail very quickly. So that is part of the identification process that we're going through right now, using the tree scan information to identify perfect candidates for these treatments moving forward. You want to talk about Mike Odom?
So the question I have, we did a number of streets in my area, we micro-surfaced them. And while they look great, then residents will call in afterwards and say, geez, it's great that you fixed the street, but now there's water pooling on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Because the micro-surfacing doesn't necessarily change the contour of the road. It sort of seals it,
yes.
Right? And so the water that is actually bad is now staying on the surface.
Yep.
It's the simplest in terms. So people are saying, why are we, you know, they're thinking we redid the road, but now the water is pooling, so we have to come back and infrared it. That's how we addressed some of them, didn't we?
Some of them.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, I want to make sure that we do something that doesn't cause that, but at the same time, if the road is not that bad, we're not changing the contour of the road. It's more so you see it near the edges, you see it near the handicap ramps, you see it in areas like that. So I just want to make sure that we address that going forward.
Sure. The one thing that I would say to that is that's about also candidate selection as well. With micro-surfacing, that's one of the things that we're going to look for when we're selecting our candidates. Does the roadway have existing good profile? Because if it doesn't, you're right. You could end up with that situation. I've seen that in other situations as well, in other towns, where they did a roadway, they looked at the surface of the roadway, but didn't necessarily look at the profile, and then that type of situation happened. So that is one thing that we're definitely looking at as part of the candidate selection for each of these streets.
So again, I won't give up.
No, they're fine
through this, but you're saying though, on a particular road, if you go and look at you're going to look at the actual road, let's say if it's crowned, it's not like that, you're saying that street wouldn't be a good candidate for a micro-surfacing, but might be a candidate for something else.
Well, if it had good crown and good profile and things like that, then I would say that would be a good candidate for micro-surfacing,
okay.
Whereas a very, very flat roadway would not be a good candidate for micro-surfacing.
Okay.
But we are looking at that, yes.
Right.
And one of the other issues it's important we need to go in and really look at the road ahead of time. And if there are areas like that, we can repair them before doing this, which we may have failed on our end. And then the other aspect is, when we were doing this, because we hadn't been crack sealing our roads, there weren't puddles because the water is going into the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we create this also. And there will be areas, I'm not going to say we're always going to get rid of every puddle, but we can come back and fix it, but we try to catch it ahead of time. But know that in this process, because of that, because we hadn't been doing a lot of crack sealing, we're going to show you, you'll see how we're going to increase that. But because we weren't doing that, the water was going away.
Right.
It was going into the crack.
Right.
Again, just know that there's going to be an educational portion of this also. It's part of, again, our outreach to the community. So we need to explain these treatments also, which we haven't done a very good job of. People think, you come in and pave my street, it's brand new. Well, no, this is really a maintenance process.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we shouldn't be saying some of the things you showed us in this class. But
I brought you to
them. I
did.
One of the things that I wanted to say about these three treatments as well is that they are a lot less intrusive, meaning in terms of construction and construction time, they're less timely to perform these types of treatments. Crack sealing can be done very quickly. It takes a truck moving down the street at a very slow rate. Fog sealing, you might close off a portion of roadway for about 45 minutes, and that's how long it takes to dry. Return traffic right to it. Micro-surfacing might be a 2 to 4 hour period that we keep traffic up a roadway, and then we put traffic right back on. So there's other benefits, not just cost and the fact that you're going to have a good roadway, but also the time it takes to do this type of work. The next treatment I'm going to talk about is cake sealing. So cake sealing is actually a combination of two different treatments. One is called chip seal, and then the other is the micro-surfacing we just talked about. So chip seal is a very, very coarse material. So it's actually a liquid asphalt that goes down the roadway, and then some stones go on top of it, basically sticks to the emulsion that's on the roadway. People don't generally like that in communities like Newton because it's very, very coarse. So rough riding surface, and there could be sometimes there's chips that come off if it's a certain type of chip seal, and generally people just don't like that in community areas. So they apply a micro-surfacing on top so that you get the smooth roadway after the treatment is done. This is actually a very effective treatment, and the reason being is because it's a little bit further down that deterioration curve, that you can hit those roadways and still have it be effective. Whereas microsurfacing and fog seal and crack seal, you're really looking at the top of the curve to preserve those roadways.
So is the purpose of that so that you can fill in some of those divots and low areas and so forth with the aggregate?
Exactly not. So the purpose of this is that so I wouldn't suggest, for instance, to use microsurfacing on a roadway that's heavily cracked. Okay? Mm-hmm. And the reason being is because microsurface, the material itself is a bit brittle. So as the roadway shifts underneath, it's going to cause those reflective cracks to come back to the top and it will crack the micro. When you put the chip seal down, you put the chip seal down first, it actually, the chip seal is very, very flexible, so it actually flexes a little bit easier than it would if it was just strictly on top of the pavement, and then therefore it doesn't reflect back through as quickly on the microsystem. So, sounds a little bit complicated, and there's a little bit more to it, but that's the easy way to explain it, that there's a reason that we're putting these two treatments together, and it's so that we can get a little bit further down the curve without having it basically deteriorate too quickly. So, in general speaking, microsurfacing is a treatment that we expect on the right roadway, you know, 5 to 8 years to get out of it, and chip seal is somewhere around the 6 to 10 year period. So you're paying a little bit more for the two different treatments, but you're allowing that, or you're expecting that treatment to last a little bit longer. The last treatment that we're going to talk about here is hot-in-place recycling. So this is another one of the pavement preservation techniques. So this is getting towards the mill and overlay category. So we're looking to actually scarify the top layer of the roadway, and then we have to seal it in with some sort of surface treatment on top. So this is a roadway that is almost in the category of unacceptable for riding purposes, but it's a costly process to use as well. So what you basically do is, this is a heater, and it goes down the road. It heats up the asphalt on the top layer. These are the scarifiers here, and they actually scarify the top layer of the pavement. And then this little machine here actually puts rejuvenator back into the pavement and then lays it back down as it goes. You have to top this treatment with something, so like a microsurfacing or something like that on top of it, because the end wearing force is not sufficient to stay in place for multiple years. It will deteriorate quickly. The nice thing about this treatment is, which differs from milling all the way, I have a video which isn't part of this presentation, but you can actually put traffic back on it right after the roller goes on. So as the train is moving down the street, the traffic is returning to it right afterwards. So it's very, very good for traffic control and things of that nature, less intrusive than doing a full-scale mill and overlay.
Yeah, so Westwood did this for the first time this year. Lou and I, we went out and saw the process, and it was really impressive because it's like mill and overlay, but an hour later, cars are driving out.
But it needs another surface?
But then you follow up with another surface, yeah.
Is it more or less expensive than a mill and overlay?
Less expensive.
Less expensive.
Yes.
So you will be seeing, we're going to try that also.
We might microsurface a road once or even twice over the life of it to prolong the life, but at some point the road's going to deteriorate enough that we have to go to mill and overlay.
I will tell you to apply that.
But you, what you're trying to do is just extend that as long as you can.
Exactly.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
So, that is my next point. Why would you want to do pavement preservation? Why wouldn't you just want to go and mill and overlay a roadway whenever it needs? So there's two approaches here. There's the reactive approach and the proactive approach that Jim talked about. So the reactive approach, you would basically get your brand new roadway, and over about a 20-year period, you would let it deteriorate, get back to the bottom, and you would go back up and you would do some major reconstruction to the roadway and let it go back down. So over the lifespan of 40 years, you would do repairs twice on this roadway at a cost of $64 per square yard, which equals up to about $1 million for 1 mile of roadway. Now, if we do the proactive approach, and I'm going to let this go through as I'm talking about it, so you're going to do all these techniques along the way. So after about 5 years, you're going to do some sort of routine maintenance, either a fog seal or a crack seal, preventative maintenance after, say, 10 years, microsurface or a chip seal, and this is going to keep going along, and you're going to keep going through this process. At about year 20, you're going to do some sort of a mill and overlay. You're not going to go in and reclaim the road like you would in the other process, but it's going to be a little bit less intrusive. So over this time, the same time period, you're going to do maintenance on the roadway 7 times instead of 2. But you're going to spend $35 per square yard for about $520,000 per mile. So there's a couple things that I want to point out here. One is obviously the cost savings that go along with it. Second is, if you notice the two curves, you never get a roadway that's in a bad state of repair. So you're keeping the roadway in a good state of repair the entire 40 years, and you're saving about half the money. So that's a perfect example of why you do pavement.
So, when does the road then deteriorate to the point when you have to do mill and overlay? I mean, it must be going down at some point.
Sure. So the way that I approach it is if you look at it from a time-based period, that's going to be at this 20-year period. So basically, you're going to go along, and after 5 years, you're going to do, say, a crack seal. After 10 years, you're going to do, say, a microsurfacing. After 15 years, you're going to do another crack seal. And after 20 years, you're going to reset the surface of that roadway by milling it all off and starting all over again. But what you've done over that time is you've never let the water get into the base of the pavement. And so that base is still in very, very good condition. So you don't have to go in and reclaim and rip the whole roadway up and do it all over again. You just have to basically reset the surface.
And if we do this right, would we theoretically ever have to reclaim the roadway?
If utility companies come up and tear the whole thing up and you have bad days and things like that, absolutely. I'm not going to sit here and say.
But assume you don't do that. I mean, theoretically, at least you wouldn't have to do that.
Sure. If the roadway is built correctly in the first place and you know you have good days and you have good, asphalt surfaces, then at some point you're probably going to have to do it, but it might be 16 years down the road or 15 years down the road, whatever it may be.
So how long have you been doing this? Is it 40 years? Do we know that this works?
Sure. A lot of this information that I pull is from industry standards. I've personally been doing this myself for 5 years. Our company has been doing this for about 13 years or so. But there's been other companies out there as well that have promoted the same type of technique and used the same type of technique. This isn't just in this area that we're using this. Actually, the Northeast is probably behind a lot of areas in the United States in doing these techniques. But the Northeast has, and the northern part of the United States has the free spot, and that's probably why they're a little bit more behind. But down south and things like that, they use these techniques all the time. So,
so if we ask you to point us to a couple of communities that have been doing this for 20 years, let's say, you could show us the data that
absolutely.
It's been cheaper and the roads are maintained well.
Yep, I'll show you an example. My next slide is a picture of a roadway that's a great example.
Let's see. Okay.
All right.
So, you have a question?
Somebody brought up utilities.
Yep.
And so this chart is a road that has never had a line or a gas line or never been ripped up. Is that what this is? Or is that?
Yeah, this is a roadway that has good base built for the beginning of it, and you're assuming that somebody was going to go and destroy it.
Okay, because we have people destroying it.
Oh, no.
All the time. Yep. So that's another.
So there's other things that we can do along the way as well. If somebody comes in and puts a huge utility line down it, for instance.
Yes, they do often.
They do all the time. We want to make sure, first off, that they're doing their trench repairs correctly, which I know the city has made extreme efforts to make sure that that's being done. Once that's done, that may accelerate the process of selecting one of these roadways for one of these treatments, because again, what we're trying to do is make sure that the water doesn't get in the cracks. So a roadway that has a brand new utility patch down it, we want to make sure that they crack seal the patch, and if they haven't, then the city should follow it up.
So is that something we should be requiring on top of what we're requiring?
Well, Lou, for instance, in one of the hearings that we were talking about, I heard him say basically the city has an ordinance in place for a roadway that was recently paved. They have to do curb mill and overlay.
Right.
That kind of ensures
well, that we do, but what if it's not within the 10 years?
We've also talked, this is going to be part of our road program also going forward. We've been talking about this, Lou and I, and Shane, so we're going to bring Conrad in on this also, and obviously some of you coming going forward here. But we really think that, you know, the more the 5-year moratorium is great, curb to curb, but we want to actually push it out maybe 5 to 10. Within the 5 to 10 year period, you infrared, because that infrared gives you that positive feel. And that's what we're losing. When you put that trench in, if you look at the trenches, eventually they're going to crack where that trench is. And as Conrad said, once that water gets in there, that's our enemy. So that's what we want to eliminate. So again, this is all part of the road program. And again, we're out there. We're going to put this thing forward. We're going to be looking for input on that.
So this will also impact clearly our ordinances. We were talking about updating that particular ordinance, and so what we learned from this can help us to craft those rules.
Yeah. And so this is why we pushed for why we pushed for her, you know, if you're going to, because next year she was going to come back when the moratorium was up,
right,
and put a trench down that road. So we actually wanted that for you, so thank you all for that.
So with the trenches, though, can we add something in that we require them to do? Something extra?
Right, this is that infrared.
So we continue to put that in our ordinances? Yes. Is that a policy?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's or continue to be a policy.
Yeah. Okay.
And we could require it in the street opening permit. As we do with the moratorium right now, we do that.
More than this.
And we were talking about the infrared. Do you want to explain the infrared
box? Go ahead. Right. Use that word.
You're the professional. So infrared is a way of patching a roadway, so basically speeding up the pavement and basically sealing it better than a conventional trench patch. So we don't have that in the program because it's not a curb-to-curb treatment, but it's just a way of patching the roadway that's much more extensive than the conventional way of basically just putting asphalt back in the place and just making sure it's patched.
So, Lou, what was it, like 50,000 by year? 50 was actually spending about 80,000 this year on infrared. Spent about 50,000 last year and the year before, and the year before that.
Right.
So we also have National Grid infrared, their trenches when they do cut open the roadway. That's been very successful as well.
I think you should add it to the program because it's yet another tool.
Yeah, another tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. No, we'll definitely continue that.
In just those instances that I was talking about, you guys did count the majority of them infrared them. So the area where we were saying that it's sealed and not a water with sand, they heated it up. I am being very simplistic and kind of laid it out a little bit better, right? So it didn't pool as much.
Right. What the infrared superheats it only does a small area. That's why it's for trenches and passes. But it superheats that area and it makes that asphalt, you can actually rake it again. So like Scott said, we could level out an area where we had some pond bank, which we did in that case.
You only do this in certain weather conditions?
Yeah, it's not because it's superheating it. We're not going to be out there when it's 20 degrees.
This is the last
week we were doing
this. It's too cold tomorrow,
actually. We
should keep going. All right. So, I told you I had a good example of paper preservation and the success. So, this is an interesting situation. So, Fairfield, Connecticut, and Bridgeport, Connecticut. I can't remember the name of this roadway, but the town line goes right down the road.
I love that.
I love that.
It's any better than this.
So, in 2004, both of the towns got together and they did a joint project, a joint overlay project. 2-inch mill and fill, conventional, you know, typical to what we would see in the city. They both spent approximately $12 per square yard to the street. In 2010, Fairfield approached Bridgeport and said, we want to do a micro-subsidy and crack seal project. Would you like to get in on this with us? Because we did it back in 2004 together. Bridgeport said, we don't do that stuff. We don't believe in it. So this is a picture of what it looks like. And this was taken in August, I believe. So, you can see the condition of the Fairfield side of the roadway, and you can see the condition of the Bridgeport side of the roadway. So in 2017, if they were to do work on both sides of these roadways, Fairfield would be looking at another crack seal and micro-surfacing project for about $4.50 a square yard. This side, on Bridgeport's side, they're either going to have to do a mill and overlay, or they're going to have to full depth reclaim this roadway. At a cost of $24 to $44 per square yard, and you can see the total here. sorry, the total there is going to be 24 to 44, so that's the 12, and I believe it's $12 to $32 per square yard for the mill and overlay or the reclaim. And then here is the total is going to be $21 per square yard after all said and done. At the end of the day, they're both going to have what look like brand new roadways. So you can see the difference in the cost, but you can also see the difference in the condition along the way. So,
I'm surprised it didn't crack right down the middle.
No, it didn't crack right down the middle. What's very interesting about this picture is that you can actually see the crack, and you can see it going into this lane. Mm-hmm. You can see the same thing here.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see it's not
going that way, yeah.
Right? So you can see where this, you know, the water is actually getting into here, and it's getting underneath, and it's continuing this crack out. So I promise you, it's not a close shot.
It looks like a lawsuit to me.
Two communities with very different funding sources.
Bridgeport
and Chesterland.
So that, it looks like Bridgeport. I actually was trying to figure this out in the picture. It looks like Bridgeport because it looks like the project about the right thing.
Yeah,
that's what Bridgeport does. But this is a perfect example of how preservation can work. Obviously, you typically don't see this situation where it goes right down the middle of the road. You have a perfect comparison. But it just happened that we got a hold of this picture, and you can't really tell the story any better than that. So if you do the right repairs at the right time, you could have success like this on a lot of your roadways. So again, that's kind of the goal of the whole program, right? We're trying to get the roadways back into good condition. They're pretty low right now. And along the way, if you don't continue to maintain the roadways that you're recently paving, they're going to continue to fall off, and you're going to be trying to catch up and just throw more money and more money and more money at it. So you want to preserve the roadways that are in good shape while also attacking the roadways that are in poor shape.
And there's something else we're not talking about. There's something else we're not talking about, which is citizens. I mean, think of all the calls we wouldn't have had over the last how many years. And this one has been a mess forever, so it's not just a money we save, but it's the quality of life.
There's a lot of
cost simultaneously.
There's a lot of benefits to this. It's just getting used to the idea that you're going to be working on roadways that are in good shape. Mm-hmm. That's usually the hardest thing to get past is the fact that you're putting more money into a roadway that you're going to put money into. It's usually one of the biggest obstacles. So this is a general idea of what we're looking to do this upcoming season in terms of the paving program. So you can see the percentages of the funding that we're looking to use on each of these repair categories. I also added in the concrete overlay here as well because that's part of the program and we're going to keep that in the program. But you can see that mill and overlay, we're going to spend about 70% of the funding on mill and overlay still. Fog seal, micro, and cave seal, we're looking to spend about 16% of the available funding. And then crack sealing, we're probably going to spend about 2% of the available funding.
What's concrete overlay?
Concrete. That's the repairs of the concrete road.
So we have about 3 miles left, about 3 miles left of the concrete road. It's a very expensive process, as you can see, but we're going to take a portion of our funding here and try to keep taking away at you.
That's to make them not concrete.
Overlay.
So that my eyes are not concrete. Thank you. So it's really asphalt. I thought you were making them more concrete.
I don't know if you remember this from our presentation. We have, I think, 2.67 miles of concrete roadway, and to do this with the concrete roadway, it's going to cost about $11 million.
The fact that you're spending only 2% on crack and sealing, but you're doing a lot of miles, it's so much cheaper.
So, as I said, just counting the concrete overlay, we just put that on there to show how expensive it is. You can see the amount of mileage that you're going to get for your money. Yeah. So mill and overlay, you're looking at about 10.3 miles of roadway is in our plan right now. Obviously, this is pending changes to priorities and things like that. Fog, micro, and cave seal, we're only using $1.5 million on that, but we're still doing more miles than we are with the mill and overlay. And then you can see the amount of miles that we're going to be able to cover with crack sealing. So $200,000 in crack ceiling goes a long way. We're going to be able to cover the Richard centerline miles. So the city has about 276 centerline miles altogether. So you can see we're actually going to cover 46 miles of roadway with this program. So
what period, what time?
This is just 1 year.
And what have we been doing in the past?
Last year, about 13 miles we touched completely, and that was the highest.
That was an overlay and just reclamation.
Well, that's what this is also. Huh? We're going to touch 46 miles of road in 1 year.
So you're going to touch more next to the city.
And the cost comparison is $9 million for 46 in 3 times. Yeah.
So this is kind of a general idea of what the program has been in the past. So we have reclaim. So about 20% of the funding was used on reclaim roadways. About 76 or so, and again, this is a general idea of the past couple of years, known overlay. Preventative maintenance was about 3% of the budget, and crack sealing was about 1% of the budget. So it's very, very small in terms of the preventative maintenance and the routine maintenance in the crack ceiling and the preventative. What we're going to try to do as this program moves along is we're going to try to continue to add money, especially to preventative maintenance, because you can't really add too much more to that routine maintenance, that crack ceiling category, because you're going to run out of roadways to do eventually. So what we're going to look to do is more of a program like this where it's more balanced. So where you're looking at fill the concrete overlay, I have it in there, reclaim at about 5% of your funding, mill and overlay at maybe around 45% of your funding, preventative is going to be around 35%, so you're going to be doing a lot more of those surface treatments, and then crack sealing where you keep it at around
2%. But total dollars have jumped substantially from the last time to this time,
yes.
So the dollar number, right. But this time is...
It would be useful to see that comparison, actually. So in addition to the pie chart, if you had the dollar amount before and proposed. And again, this is kind of the first stages of the program. So this is kind of a goal that we're setting in terms of percentages of the budget.
Right.
So we'll continue to develop this as we go along, and we'll be able to put dollars to this and things like that and set realistic goals. But this was kind of our first shot at where do we want to get to in the future.
So it's very impressive. I guess what I wanted to suggest, though, is because you right away went to we're going to be touching 46 miles of road, and the last year was touching 12 miles of road.
Yep.
So, but that's the wrong message to send out to the community because, you know, first of all, people could flip out thinking that we're going to be all over the city all at once,
sure.
Which is not what you're proposing. But also it's a whole different...
Right. And this is for the group that really understands what we're trying to do. We would never present this to the community. We're going to say, okay, we're going to be working on the street doing this process. But I don't think it would be beneficial to put this out.
I think that telling people you're spending 3 times as much money on the roads is really good, and I think actually most people, given the condition of our roads, would be thrilled to see that you're going to be out there doing work, and there's actually a chance in my lifetime that the roads in my neighborhood will get done.
Isn't there a point at which the curve starts going down on the amount that you have to spend after X number of years when you get this all under control and it looks like the Fairfield, Connecticut side?
I was happy to answer that. So when we worked with Tucan, so Tucan is going to have a role to play in this also as we move forward. There are two different things. One is the algorithm that they put together for us. They are going to recalculate each year based on the roadways that we do touch and what we do to them. They're going to recalculate all the degradation charts for the type of road and the amount of traffic on the roadway, and then they'll know what we did to it. They're going to recalculate our average PCI every year. So as part of their whole algorithm, we're going to know what the average what the PCI is on each roadway. And that's going to happen on an annual basis. We will probably have them come back every third year.
Yeah, after year three, we're going to have them come back, as Maureen said, and scan the entire city again, because now we have our baseline. this will reinforce that we're on the right track, or hopefully we're doing better than what we anticipated, because we're hoping to see some cost savings through these other treatments that Conrad's sharing with us.
And so this is a 10-year plan at about $9.5 million a year for the 10 years. When we get to year 11, we have two scans cost this out for us also. And I want to say that we've seen in the $6 or $7 million range going forward as our annual maintenance spend. But that will be, we will have at that point in time, hopefully actually, raise our average PCI for the local to 72, for the main and arterials to 80. So we will have improved the students throughout the city, and that is going to be really an annual plan of, I think it was close to 7 million. So part of the full funding strategy is for the treatments that will add many, many years to the lifetime of the road. So the milling overlay and the concrete overlay. Those are both candidates for bonding. And so within my model, I have it so that we would do a 10-year bond up to as much as, and it's really in like the $6.2 million range, because we are still assuming that we would have at least 2.3 of Chapter 90 and over $1 million from our override $1 million that we have. So the assumption is we will have 3.3 to 3.5 million a year from our budget. Okay, and then obviously if those numbers can increase, part of my model, I'm trying to increase what we have in that override $1 million funding account. The beauty of this though, so we will be growing that number in the 10 years. So we would be less and less bonding, but more money, just like we've grown into the cost for snow removal in the city. If we add to that number slowly, we're going to get to a point where after the 10 years, so if we bond with $6.2 million for 10 years, then that bond runs out and you have about 700, or about 10% of it. You have about $700,000 that's freeing up in your debt that can then go right into the actual budget for the city. And so this is all assuming not taking any money like from free cash or anything else. Well, certainly over the course of the year, whether it's from overlay surplus or free cash, or if we have attrition in different departments and we decide to pool some funds and put it into paving, the goal would be not to really bond it to $6.2 million every year. But after 10 years, when we've gotten everything paid, we need to have ourselves set up so that we've got that $7 million between Chapter 90, the override money, and whatever we've added to the operating budget through this time. Because at that point, you wouldn't be bonding, for instance, because that would then be the main. And so the only reason that these are categories for bonding is because we can clearly go to bond council and sign an attestation that says that by milling overlaying or the concrete overlay, that we are absolutely extending the life of the road by at least 10 years. So there's a whole different sector, as much as all the engineering that's going into this, there's then the whole financial part of the model.
Then we can do the same thing for buildings.
Absolutely.
You don't want to focus on the
finances. I don't want to focus on finances tonight.
But just so you know, we're planning all of that.
Yeah. I don't know how much more presentation there is.
No,
I'll go to the last one.
On the model that we talked about, you know, where we started 100, get down to 70, back up, and this might be a dumb question, but does this take into consideration the amount of like salt that we use? You know, because we had a period of time a couple of years ago where we made some adjustments about how much salt we were actually putting on the road. Is that all net? Okay, is that all like taken into consideration?
And do you have recommendations for what product to use?
Yeah, like we did a period of time where
there was a winter or two, maybe even before this administration, where, you know, we tried the pre-treatment and that didn't work, and then we tried a brine one time and that may have worked. And I'm just trying to, was that considered as part of the model?
So the model that I showed is the average deterioration for basically the New England area. But along the way, and as part of the roads program, there'll be a lot of discussion about, you know, how roadways are treated and things like that. Like, I know, for instance, in the example that I put up there, Fairfield, because they're using so many different types of surface treatments, they're getting creative and trying out different plowings and things like that, so that they can make their surface treatments last longer, but still get the life or what they need to do with their snow removal. So there's a lot of different things that are going to come up along the way in terms of maintaining the products that we're putting down. But again, this is the first year of kind of putting a program together, so those will be discussed as we go along.
And just to follow up real quickly, and I'll stop. So, like, for instance, if you did a cake seal,
yep,
and you're like, you weren't supposed to put salt down on a cake seal road, but, you know, you can on a micro surface, so you get into that level of...
Oh, yeah. I mean, in terms of putting certain salt on certain roadways,
yeah,
in terms of certain treatments, I haven't run into that yet.
Okay.
But again, we'll kind of assess those treatments along the way. The one thing that we're going to want to do, too, is we're going to want to look at the different treatments and which ones the city deems as successful and which ones they don't. Because, there's a lot of different pros and cons to each of the treatments. They're not brand new asphalt. They're different types of treatments and they're used for different types of things. So we want to make sure that we're using them on the candidates that will make them the most successful, and then also evaluating whether or not the city wants to then proceed with those different treatments. One of the things that we talked about in our first meeting was, I want to get the city staff out to take a look at some of these products before we go ahead and move forward with them. Like, for instance, you know, fog seal, for instance. I've worked with a bunch of communities that have done fog seal and advised them on different types of roadways in neighborhood roads versus collector roads versus arterial roads. So just because I've worked with so many communities, I can take the city staff out and take a look at how they've progressed over time, and then that'll be part of our evaluations as well. So, because not, like I said, the chip seal, for instance, a conventional chip seal, it's a great treatment, but I would never use it in the city because it would cause more complaints than it's worth. But out in Western Mass, I would use that treatment all day long. So it's kind of assessing the situation, assessing what the needs are in the city, and that's all part of this process that we're going through.
And if I could just jump in and add, and that's where our relationship, like with street scan, is going to be so important. Because if we have them back every 3 years, and we know it's about $125,000 for them to evaluate the entire city, that was short money for what we got out of it. And so we need to make sure that we're committed to understanding where we are with the different road treatments, the salt treatments, all those highways, whatever we're doing, we absolutely need to keep assessing where we are.
So there's so much to be excited about, that we did the assessment, we're putting more funding to, or that we're doing it in a sophisticated way, and now we'll do the, but now what do we do about this? So a resident who lives on Gammons Road, it happens to be Ward 5, but they know me, so they contacted me. It's a tiny little neighborhood road. You know, you wind up to it, and there's 5-6 houses. There is 10 houses probably up there. The road's dreadful. I emailed Lou, what's the PCI and where is it on the CIP? And the PCI is 15.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not on the CIP
because
it's too little. So even with all we're doing, you can have a really, really unsafe small neighborhood road. And it seems like we have to marry everything we're doing with looking at any road, I'm making this up, between 0 and 20 or 0 and something, and say, I know we've got to do all this, but somehow you can't go on a road trip tomorrow There's roads that are below some number. Mm-hmm. Even if they're tiny. But I don't know what that means for funding. And is that, you know, another
20%? So this is going to be part of our strategy. This is what we're building. So we're going to anticipate that, because when we formulated this program, we didn't take into these other truths. So we know we're going to see some cost savings. So, and we just started kicking this around. We said, do we take those savings, if we do have them, or years where there's free cash? And my thought is, because we've addressed, we prioritize these roads, are the arterials, the collectors, near village centers, schools, transit. So your little side roads are left behind. So we need to talk about this. This is going to be part of our roads program. Do we take that extra funding and say, okay, we're going to allocate so much of that and start at the bottom of the list?
And then we work
from both directions. So we get that. And I've driven down those roads. So when I saw the PCI, when it first came out, and I said, we can't have the 10s and 13s. We do. But there are those roads that go to nowhere, but we really need to
take them on it.
And that's something else to talk to Conrad about. There may be other treatments, but in some of those scenarios, because in talking to Lou, a lot of the base throughout the city is in good shape. Whoever originally built the city, if it was city roads, we have a good base. So we may be able to do a less invasive process on these roads that aren't heavily traveled. It may not need that full depth reclamation, but we've accounted for that. So again, we're hoping that we were conservative enough, and we'll see this when we go forward. I don't want to commit to it, but that's what we should be doing. If there are extra funds, we need to start seeding it from the bottom.
I just encourage you, when you come back, to add the data about in the next 10 years, we'll have eliminated anything that's 5 and below, and 10 and below, and 15 and below, and just show us over the 10 years as you work the bottom up as well, what the plan looks like. Be pretty clear with us, and so we.
So one of the things I talked about with Jim last week, and I know you didn't give it to us after all, of course, one of our questions is always going to be, what roads are up for next year? What roads are up over the 5 years? And since this is a 10-year plan, what roads are up over the 10 years? And I heard you say this last week, that you're not exactly there yet, because you've got still a lot of moving parts. But when you do that, so my sense is
that they're in the CIP.
Well, that's right. So the group steering data is in the CIP. So it's there. But that's where we're starting.
Okay.
So we just need to coordinate the utilities.
That's where I was going to go.
Right, and that's what we're doing right now.
We have a huge amount of coordination still to understand.
Right.
Particularly with the gas utilities, unknowable.
Right, so all we may do is substitute, if this certain street was 3,000 feet long, we're just going to substitute in another 3,000 feet. So note, there's going to be slight changes, but that's only because of utilities. And we're coordinating that. We just, last month's meeting, we gave NGRID our list. That's when they requested from us. And we gave it to them right away. So here's what we're proposing.
So in year 10, there are no roads left that are below 72 or 80, exactly.
That's the average.
That's
the average.
Yeah.
How can you have 15s in there and move that out?
Well, hopefully
there's
not. And some of those roads, look, it depends on the road. It's gonna come up. Eventually, we went out 5 years because that's practical. We could go out 10, but we want to see, at the end of year 3, we're going to have a great snapshot of where we're at, and then we can really project out even further.
I kind of changed it a little bit, and what I mean by that is, if you went out 5, right, or now going out 10 before, when you were doing 5, 96% of what you were doing was reclaim, mill, and overlay. right?
Yeah. Yeah, for the technique.
Right? From the technique that's going to be, so now that the world's 5 and 10 years, there's going to be a lot of variations with that if we've now switched that model to 81%.
Yeah, let me just speak to that real quick. So, like I said, I work with, or our company works with over 120 communities on very, very similar situations as this. Not to this scale all the time, but, you know, small scales, big scales, whatever it may be. I don't think I've ever seen a community put together a 5-year plan that they stuck to. because of so many different situations.
Right.
So what I try to do with the communities that I work with is I try to put together a very, very solid 3-year plan. Basically, 5 years is, year 4 and 5 are almost like wish lists, but they're, you know, high priorities in those years. And year 5 to 10 are really projections. So that's our goal as part of the program as well, especially, you know, within the first year, is to have that 3-year, 5-year, 10-year kind of plan laid out. And again, it's going to change on a yearly basis. And I explained this to Jim and Shane and Blue when we came in. This is a yearly thing that you come in and you take a look, because all it takes is one water road that we were going to mill and overlay in year 2 to not get completed, and it really blows apart year 2. So you can imagine what that does to year 3, 4, and 5. So again, we're going to try to put together the best plan we can for even a 10-year period. But it's going to change along the way, and streets are going to get moved from year to year, and a street might get shifted up or it might get shifted down.
Right.
So,
Mark has a question.
So, following up on what Roseanne said, you're going to in some way move from the bottom up so that we don't have any streets and below a certain number, say 15%, 20%, 25%, whatever that is. I'd ask when you come back to us after you've given some thought to what's appropriate, you give us some kind of sense of what your policy is going to be on that.
Yeah,
at least the ultimate policy goal, like no street in the city shall be below 40%, if that's the policy goal. And second, I don't think you want to touch on this tonight, but I understand this is all part of kind of a complete street type of program we've talked about, where when you do a street, you're looking at it from the property line to property line inward, including street trees and signs and sidewalks. Is that still the plan?
Yeah, so that's the funds you see here take into account sidewalks, curbing, trees also. You see, we really have to adjust that going forward because we see the impact.
Well, trees would come out of a different budget.
Yeah.
The money for the trees are not part of the 9.5.
What about money for, like, you know, you're in there,
you're attacking
sidewalks. New street signs when you're putting, I mean, you know, whether it's a no parking sign that goes in the sidewalk or a new street sign in the corner, is that all part of this as well?
Yes, we're going through, we're walking in these streets, and we started doing that this past year. You know, we do major repair on the streets. So what we're going to do is, the streets we're doing maintenance on, we're not committing to bringing those into true complete streets. And when we're on the majority, those other streets, you see the majority, the mill and overlay, we're going through and we're doing all that, as you said, from the curb. Like Maury said, the trees, they're included in our plan, but not the cost. Parks and Rec is carrying them.
As you do that, I'd urge you to even look at even something as simple as a no parking sign, okay? Where, you know, that you got a sign that's bent and half off, and you're there. That's the time to fix that stuff. I just think it makes a huge difference in terms of people's perception.
No, I agree. You'll see that happen.
All right,
going
that's great.
You will.
Thank you.
So, while we're putting a policy together for those 10 roads that are in terrible shape, we also need to figure out what we're doing with the private land. And how many miles do we have?
23 miles, something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of those are says why this is public goals would be, I mean, they're not actually, you know, quote unquote our city standards. And so along the way we're gonna certainly have to have those conversations too.
That's a policy discussion too. Absolutely, that's why I mentioned it. When I first came on the board back in 1987, we did some change the ordinance and did private way lot in place, which goes from High Street to Route 9 in Upper Falls. And the people who were around then are now saying it's really falling apart, you gotta do something on that. So I second what someone's saying. The other question would be is, on some streets you see a repavement, and there are still ponding on that street afterwards, including, you know, one section of Chestnut I'm thinking of, where in front of somebody's driveway, there's water there for like 5 days after a downpour, even though it's like 20 feet away from a storm drain. With the treatments you're talking about, will be conditions like that?
Well, we have that's usually a condition where there's a settlement there. You know, if the treatment plant is going to do that. When we do an overlay or anything of that nature, that's when we're addressing that. The maintenance treatments aren't going to fix those loads. We need to actually go in and physically do that, whether we jackhammer that out and build it back up. But that's what needs to be done beforehand, before we do these treatments. Which again is why we're walking these streets. We can't just rely solely on the street scan data. We still have to go out there, boots on the ground, and evaluate each street.
So, is that your question? I've got two questions. One is really simple. If you had a link to a summary sheet on the different methodologies, particularly the ones we haven't used here, I'd be personally interested in looking at them. It doesn't have to be a spec sheet, but just a summary that kind of gives us a little more information on
I have to provide a web link that has everything on it.
Okay, that'd be great. And then the big elephant in the room for me for a long time has been police details. We have had, with the amount of work we're doing today, we've had a huge problem with getting sufficient police details. Some of our building projects, not our personal, but some private projects have been put on hold for a week or two for not being able to get a police detail. We're going to expand our street work substantially. How are we going to tackle that?
Well, I'm glad you asked. And obviously that is doing a lot of the conversation on another night. You know, we've solved some of that. But we've had conversations about, first of all, how much of this and on which streets should this work be done at night. And so when we put the big packages together, doing some of this work at night certainly needs to be part of our plan. The whole issue with the details, we've actually opted a little bit for whenever we had our latest staff meeting, what we did was we broke into, I think we had four groups, and the whole purpose of breaking out was for people to identify icebergs that were out there, you know, that were things that were external to us, but are good things that we know that we need to deal with. And so clearly the details, gridlock, congestion from all the work that's happened was clearly one of the areas.
That was my iceberg.
It was mine too, I think I did. But so we know it's a huge issue. So we're putting a team together. We're talking about technology ways to address this as one of our solutions. And this is going to be, we're going to come back to it because what we may need to change is in ordinances as time goes on to handle this. But we're going to use our GIS system to figure out if there are areas in the city where we shouldn't be allowing permits for work to be done, say before 9 a.m. If it's a very busy area where it creates problems in the morning, we're going to identify streets that no matter what happens, have to have a detail. We're going to identify streets that maybe don't need to have a detail if we're working on them, that they're small enough And so we need to figure out how we're going to do all that. So technology will be a part of it. Certainly looking at whether or not we expand our toolkit, if you will, for details to auxiliary solutions. We need to have that conversation. Apparently, I think it's about 70 bodies that we would be able to add to our people who would be available. Now, you know, this if we're doing all of this, the work that we're doing. I mean, we haven't been able to get details to take down some of the trees. Our tree program, the building program, the water and sewer program, the paving program, with the utilities and grid is out there, you know, trying to get their details too. So we've got to have the city do a much better job of managing how many permits we're giving per day. And so we talked about maybe even having someone that knows how many, you know, that really is watching this whole thing holistically, and, you know, that we're giving out a certain number of permits per day. So that's why I said I'm glad that we're kind of here tonight, so that you know that we are working on, I don't have the solution tonight, about the details, but it is a huge issue for us. And we're going to have to work together and figure out how we solve it.
Lauren, can I have your computer program?
For the streets, I'm not saying we're getting people to build a meeting.
Lot of Nolan overlay was just done on Hammond Street and Suffolk Road, and you guys, that was amazing, and really, he was there crack of dawn until after dark, and was so responsive to individual neighbors. It was just great. And boy, he needed the details on Hammond Street, but Suffolk Road, there were a lot of police standing around that was really
good. Well, I want to thank you greatly for this evening. We've been awaiting this for a long time, worth the wait. I know we're all eager to get going and solve everything all at once, but you know, we can't do that.
It's a
very good start. I'm very pleased and looking forward to more.
Thank you all for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure. We good?
With that, we will adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
I don't have a